Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system.
So it's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 16th of September 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol, and on the talkradio.org.uk stream. The reason we're called the Not the BCFM Politics Show is partly to do with a programme that Esther herself was on when we were on FM, which was looking at the Mayor's father, Valentine Walker, our Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees's father. Valentine was involved in altercations of various sorts during the St. Paul's riots, the famous 1980s riots. And we did a programme which the station manager himself did not like, which was pointing out that the anti-apartheid leader at the time was actually driven out. At least that was the allegation, driven out of the city. And we spoke to him himself, we tracked him down and was training the national football team in Ghana, actually, by the mayor's father. And then we had Steve Norman, who's a long-time Labour Party campaigner, not with us now any longer, sadly, saying, and this is the interview, I think, which caused the controversy and the difficulty, was saying what... Where Marvin Rees is now, the mayor, is a result of what his father did for the establishment in driving out the leader of the anti-apartheid movement. Actually, the thing that really got me to stand that story up was getting hold of some articles from the 1980s of the court case where Valentine Walker was accused of assault or attempted murder of this guy Balogun, who was the leader of the anti-apartheid movement. And at that court case, I could not believe reading it. The judge said, oh, well, I think that you stuck the machete into your own neck in order to frame Valentine Walker. Anyway, the result, the rest is history, because young Marvin was tapped up, sent to these big US universities, and the result is now we have one of the pals of Alexei Navalny running Bristol for the Labour Party. Anyway, that's just a little resume of why it's called Not the BCFM Politics Show, because we used to be on FM here in Bristol. In fact, we were for 12 years. So anyway, you can also listen to this programme on the BCFM Politics Show app. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade, zero-carbon Ukraine psychological warfare propaganda, as well as promoting, sometimes even, medical misinformation. Guests tonight, Labour Party activist and economist Esther Giles, and also from the Bristol Muslim Cultural Society, Farouk Siddiq. Are you still at the... Farouk?
No, not. I've left now.
Okay, so would you like to introduce yourself? Yeah. That's how I last knew you. So how would you like to introduce yourself tonight?
So at the moment I'm representing the Bristol Pakistan Association.
Very pertinent. So also joining us on the line is a London-based author of The Battle of the Beanfield and freelance journalist who's written a lot about the Guantanamo Bay incarcerations. That's Andy Worthington, and navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, and maybe even into a Third World War. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Anyway, we'll start this week, I think, by just sort of introducing our guests. And we'll start with you, Andy, on the line there in London. Now, I know that you've written in all sorts of areas, as I just mentioned, the attack on the travellers in the 1980s by the Thatcher government, also on Guantanamo. But what is it that drove you last week to write what I thought was a fascinating piece about the Liz Truss's big announcement on one of the best days to bury bad news there's ever been, which is last Thursday in the House of Commons? She announced this energy price guarantee, she calls it.
Well, it was simply because there is absolutely no intention on the part of Liz Truss or the far right libertarians, as they call themselves, so many of them connected with the Tufton Street think tanks, to make the energy industry at all responsible for the current unaffordability crisis of quite possibly the worst winter of our lifetimes economically. No talk of a bailout in the slightest, just this kind of thin press release with no details about how there would be support, but not through any costs being transferred onto the companies, just the burden basically being put onto the public. And of course, we haven't heard any more of it since, because the Queen died, and now, you know, all business has been shut down for weeks. But you know, it made me livid, Tony, that that what was being proposed and what wasn't really spelled out in so much of the media coverage was that if she's going to borrow money to pay the companies directly for the loss of their profits, then that's one thing. But the other thing is that the way of recouping this borrowing is by putting it onto the taxpayers of the UK, probably for the next 10 or 20 years. And that was the bit that I didn't think was...
But hang on, Andy. It's not the first time, is it? This happened in 2008. It also happened, apparently, in 2019, just before the pandemic, too.
The thing about those, Tony, is that, you know, I'm not an economist, so I wouldn't know exactly how that manifested itself in terms of what we were required to do. But this seems very much a straightforward case of, are you going to get this money by going after the companies who have made windfall profits, extraordinary windfall profits, or are you going to actually put it in a way that we will be able to see onto our bills over the next 20 years to cover it? And as far as I can see, that is actually what they're hoping to get away with. And I think that it's absolutely crucial that if at all possible, we don't let them get away with it.
Well, listen, I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, Andy, to your article. But can you summarise what you think she should have done?
Well, I think she clearly should have imposed a windfall tax on the energy companies. And I see that the EU is now going to levy a windfall tax of £120 billion. So I just did a quick calculation, Tony. And as far as I can see, comparing population to population, with 447 million people in the EU and 67 in the UK, that means that we should have a windfall tax of £18 billion. Put onto the companies by the British government. And obviously, if we were still part of the EU, that would be part of the deal. But we're not. But when Parliament eventually reconvenes, if they do, I mean, I'm pretty sure that Truss and her far-right libertarians would like to, just not actually bother with Parliament at all. But if we do get back, then I think we absolutely need to be pressing for a similar windfall tax to be introduced in the UK.
Well, you know what? You've just reminded me of something, and that is, of course, the government is still functioning. Parliament is suspended, but government is still carrying on. In fact, departments like the Treasury, etc., are still chugging along, doing their thing. They're not suspended. Anyway, before we hear from Martin Summers on this, let's go to Liz Truss, because this is what we missed in the news on last Thursday evening, and the analysis of this. This is a couple of minutes long. This is just where she announced in the Commons last Thursday what her great solution to the cost of living crisis is going to be, particularly with regard to these energy companies. Now, it's also worth noting, and I was my eyebrows were raised slightly by during the so-called leadership campaign during August and the 6 weeks or so that she was competing with Rishi Sunak for the affections of the Tory party members. She kept this plan she announced last Thursday very close to under her hat. I was very surprised. I would have thought in an election, what these candidates should be doing is setting out their stall. This is what I intend to do about these rising energy costs. No, Liz Truss refused to do that. Rishi Sunak came a little bit closer. But if you're going to have an election, surely you need to know what you're voting for, don't you? Apparently not, according to Liz. Anyway, let's go back to last Thursday and hear her announcement in the Commons.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move the motion. Earlier this week, I promised I would deal with the soaring energy prices faced by families and businesses across the UK. And today, I am delivering on that promise. This government is moving immediately to introduce a new energy price guarantee that will give people certainty on energy bills. It will curb inflation and boost growth. This guarantee, which includes a temporary suspension of green levies, means that from the 1st of October, a typical household will pay no more than £2,500 per year for each of the next 2 years while we get the energy market back on track.
Yeah, yeah.
This will save a typical household £1,000 a year. It comes in addition to the £400 energy bill support scheme. This guarantee supersedes the Ofgem price cap and has been agreed with energy retailers. We will deliver this. Mr. Speaker, I will make way in a few minutes when I have made some progress. Mr. Speaker, we will deliver this by securing the wholesale price for energy while putting in place long-term measures to secure future supplies at more affordable rates. We are supporting this country through this winter and next, and tackling the root causes of high prices so we are never in the same position again. For those using heating oil, living in park homes, or those on heat networks, we will set up a fund so that all UK consumers can benefit from equivalent support.
I thank her for giving me. National Energy Action estimate with the cap at the current level are 6.5 million households in fuel poverty. So raising the cap to £2,500, how many more millions of people will end up in fuel poverty, do you reckon?
Well, Mr. Speaker, we are taking action to help people on the lowest incomes through universal credit, and we are also supplying £400 through the energy bills support scheme. Mr. Speaker, I would like to make some progress and then I will take more interventions. We will also support all businesses, charities and public sector organisations with their energy costs this winter, offering an equivalent guarantee for 6 months. After those 6 months, we will provide further support to vulnerable sectors such as hospitality, including our local pubs.
Okay, so that's Liz Truss last Thursday. Martin, what do you make of what she's announcing there? Because at least she's saying, actually, these increases in energy bills for businesses, charities, people that are living in mobile homes in the countryside, and ordinary householders are all going to be supported by the government now.
Well, what she's saying is that the energy companies, the energy oligopoly, which is making a lot of money as a result of the situation, are going to be given taxpayers' money to create a price cap for everybody, poor and rich alike. So it's a big handout for rich people here. And, of course, rich people tend to vote Tory, and that will be the reason why she pitched it in that particular way. But, of course, we've forgotten all about balancing the books,
haven't we? If that's the reason, there's no reason for her to support poor people at all, is there?
Well, except that she's got to go through the motions of pretending to care about them, even though they don't vote for her. Some of them may vote for them. It's not. You can't presume anything. The thing that's significant about it is all of that stuff. Do you remember austerity, where we had to close down all sorts of things, sack 20,000 police officers, all the rest of it? In actual fact, we didn't have to do any of that because the government can just decide it's going to spend money and put it on the credit card. That's what she did there. And in actual fact, the Tory press ought to be going mad. But of course, they're not going mad because it's money they want spent on their people, and therefore money's no object.
Okay, so before we hear from Esther Giles on this same topic, we've got Keir Starmer's reply to that speech. It was actually, it wasn't all that easy to find it, but here is his response, at least the beginning of it, to the announcement last Thursday, which was really lost by the death of Queen Elizabeth II.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and can I thank the Prime Minister for advanced sight of her opening speech. We're in the middle of a national emergency. People are really scared, and families don't know if they can warm their homes this winter, and businesses ask if they can keep the lights on. That is why the Labour Party spent the summer fighting for a price freeze, so that no household would pay a penny more on their bills. When we called for it, many people said we were wrong. They pretended that this crisis was something that just affected the poorest, as if working families on average wages could easily shoulder astronomical bills. They dismissed our call for support as handouts. Yes. But those objections could never last, The Prime Minister had no choice. No government can stand by while millions of families fall into poverty, whilst businesses shut their doors and the economy falls to ruin. So I am pleased there is action today, and that the principle of a price limit has been accepted. But under our plan, not a penny more on bills. Under this plan, a price rise. But this support... I'll just make some progress and then I will. But this support does not come cheap. And the real question before the House today, the real question the government faces, the political question, is who is going to pay? The Treasury estimates that energy producers could make £170 billion in unexpected windfall profits over the next 2 years. I repeat that, £170 billion in unexpected windfall profits over the next 2 years. I will give way in just a moment. The head of BP has called this crisis a cash machine for his company. And households are on the other end of that cash machine, their bills funding these eye-watering profits. That's why we've been calling for a windfall tax since January. And it's why we want to see the windfall tax expanded now. But the Prime Minister is opposed to windfall taxes. She wants to leave these vast profits on the table with one clear and obvious consequence. The bill will be picked up by working people. She claims that a windfall tax will deter investment. That's ridiculous. These vast profits are not the reward of careful planning. They are the unexpected windfall from Putin's barbarity in Ukraine. There's no reason why taxing them would affect investment in the future. Don't just take my word for it. Asked which investment BP would cancel if there was a windfall tax, the chief executive said, none. None. His words, not mine.
So that's the Labour opposition leader Keir Starmer there explaining that really that this is a windfall tax, is something they've been calling for a long time, and actually the energy companies have done quite well out of this, really, is what he's saying, and he's right.
Yes, they absolutely have. BP and Shell, between them, made profits of $17 billion in the quarter ended June 2022.
Okay, that's a quarter.
One quarter. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's, we're talking about roughly $70 billion annual profits.
Yes. Right. Yes. The if I may, I'd like to pick up on some of the issues already raised. I actually agree with Keir Starmer about the wealth tax. And picking up on Martin's point about and points previously made about why support this, why do we support the banks in 2008? Well, this is all about stalling the collapse of capitalism, which of course is doomed to fail. Trust cannot leave the public starving and cold. The public just would not stand it, so she had to intervene. It's her responsibility. She knew she had to intervene, but she's intervened in a very inadequate way. And I can go on.
Yes, please. Yeah. Tell us what you think she should have done, then.
So, if you look back, all of this problem started in 1986 when Margaret Thatcher started to sell off all of the national assets, including British Gas. And of course, now our main national indigenous supply is via Centrica, which owns British Gas and the whole supply chain associated with British Gas. Apart from that, all of our supply comes from elsewhere, including a lot of our gas from Norway and, of course, oil from all over the world. And the issue here is that Liz wants to control the energy market in saying she'll pay out $130 billion, $200 billion to subsidise the public. She's not addressing actual supply. Now, she does have some good points in what she said she wanted to do, because she's saying we need to expand national supply so that we can have greater self-sufficiency in fuel, which will help with these issues around gas and oil supply. but she's not actually pursuing a route which is very friendly with regard to climate change, because she's basically opening a free-for-all in the North Sea, and she's going to allow fracking to continue.
Yeah, she didn't talk about that right then, but fracking is definitely on the cards now, isn't it? What about, I mean, the one word we haven't heard so far is re-nationalised. Now, this is, in fact, within the last few weeks, I've been listening to even Conservative MPs on the radio talking about, for example, with the water companies, re-nationalising them. Is that feasible?
Well, renationalising energy is a little bit more complicated than that, because the trade unions have been talking about renationalising supply. But supply isn't the problem here. The problem is extraction. And if you were to renationalise extraction, you'd be talking about Shell, $199 billion, BP, $90 billion. You'd be talking about big international energy providers.
She's talking about a subsidy in total of $130 billion anyway.
Yeah, indeed she is. But in my view, we should focus firstly on local supply, so Centrica, British Gas, which is actually responsible for a lot of extraction in this country. But the other thing that not many people have come across is the fact that gas supply is a main problem here with fuel inflation. And Centrica is responsible for much of gas supply in this country, and it's closed down its gas storage facilities at Rough, which means that we can't store gas in this country, and which means that we in this country are subject to all the vagaries of the international markets and the acceleration in inflation across the world.
Martin, isn't this something that's actually at the back of all of this, which is that actually energy now has become a casino? It's not we're not pumping the stuff out of the ground and selling it to people that need to cook their poached egg at cost, are we?
No, and what used to happen in this energy market, it wasn't really a market, because in actual fact countries used to think of this as to do with national security controlling energy supply. So, for example, in Russia, which no doubt we'll come on to discuss it later in the programme, there were attempts to privatise Gazprom in the 1990s. And, of course, the reaction of what they call the Siloviki, which is the sort of security state in Russia, was we're not privatising our gas and oil supply. That's the main source of income for the government. And so Gazprom, in fact, had very long-term relationships with countries like Germany. They were supplying on 30-year contracts, guaranteed prices. They were supplying, because of course, the many countries in Eastern Europe were dependent on Russian gas. And the Russians didn't do anything to upset that. They said, we're happy to carry on supplying you with, below market prices, on long-term terms.
And Farouk, you want to come in there?
Yeah, I think everything that Martin and Esther said is 100% I agree with, but what really gets my goat of all of this is that it's just blatant daylight robbery. What we're seeing here is we've been told that our energy prices are going to go up by 3,000, maybe up to 5,000 in January 23. What she's done now is by terrifying everyone that all these prices are going to go up. What she's actually done is on the 1st of October, she's cemented the profits of those energy companies that they are going to make, or they were making, where they were making all these mega profits already. She cemented that. And what she said to them is that, I will pay you the extra. We're going to give a discount to the people, right? We're going to subsidize that so that nobody's bill, supposedly a typical bill, doesn't go over 2,500, which I'll believe when I see it. But what's galling is that it's just a sleight of hand. She is literally guaranteeing...
Well, it's giving money to the people who are profiteering.
Exactly. It's guaranteeing
the profits. Taking money off it, not giving it to
those mega profits. I mean, that we've got price fixing going on, actually, that they have been putting the... I mean, for example, last autumn, we had an enormous leap in the fuel prices. Apparently, Shell were so broke that they couldn't afford to pay delivery drivers to take fuel to the petrol stations. Well, I was scratching my chin at that one. Because they are some of the most wealthy bodies on the planet, the energy companies, and if they wanted to offer a bit of a raise to another delivery driver, I'm sure they could have done it. But anyway, Andy Worthington, back to you. I mean, you did this, I think, excellent study of the Thatcher's battle with the Travellers, the Battle of the Beanfield back in the 1980s, where a lot of this privatisation was going on. Do you think, is it feasible simply to re-nationalise these various institutions. And here, obviously, we're talking here about the big energy companies. BP was, the British government did have a golden share in BP, had 51% ownership or something. So if they had that sort of control, you know, they could just tell BP what to do and what price to set at the pumps.
Well, you know, I think Esther was saying that there were some complications, you know, I mean, partly because everything is so international now. But I would certainly like to see it being looked at, and I would like to see some political leadership on that as an alternative to what's being proposed by the government. But I do also think, Tony, that, you know, the thing that's not being discussed here, this is very much to do with the Truss government, which is absolutely in bed with the oil and gas companies. And you could almost hear the relish with which she was dropping the green levy. She's not interested at all in renewables, in absolute defiance of the way that not only public concerns, but actually the ability to make money on the part of companies is going in the direction of renewables. And in Britain, we could clearly, I think, bring online some renewable energy sources, which all of her proposals for fracking, for fossil fuel extraction, and for nuclear, what we're looking at are things that are going to take quite a long time to come online. In the case of nuclear, we're looking at decades. We need to have renewables that can be brought online very quickly, and we need to have a government that backs those ideas. So, you know, that I think is another angle. But I would very much like to see politicians propose nationalisation and also investigate properly the price fixing that is involved, which is one of the reasons why our bills are so high in the first place, because bills are pegged to the profits of the most expensive suppliers. There's a whole can of worms there, which, you know, as so often these days, Tony, we really rarely hear any detailed explanation of in the mainstream media, but it is something that's worth digging into.
Well,
is
yeah,
exactly
certainly.
How the prices are set.
Martin, what about this whole idea of regulating these industries into submission and nationalising them for nothing?
That's exactly how you do it. You don't, because the current share price is dependent upon the lack of regulation. So you regulate the industry to the point at which it can't really make a profit, and then the people who own it hand it over to the government because they'd rather get rid of it. And that's, for example, how they nationalise the oil industry in South America.
That takes an administration with true grit, doesn't it?
It does, and you see, we're not allowed to discuss nationalisation in the Labour Party now, because it's been
Rachel Reeves.
Rachel Reeves went to Liverpool and said, well, we can't do that because of the pandemic, there's no money, so we can't talk about renationalisation. Now, that, of course, is the wrong conclusion, because what the pandemic showed is if you want to spend money, you can spend money. There's a limit to that, but I think people have woken up to the fact, hang on, when you've got a national emergency, the government can get its checkbook out. We used to know that. And, of course, it's suddenly, even on a visceral level, people understand, well, hang on, mate, that's right.
Well,
because, of course, the whole austerity policy, as I said earlier, was just wrong.
Well, Starmer
just self-harm.
Said in his speech in the Commons last Thursday, talked about, Putin's barbaric attack on Ukraine is really responsible for all of this. But is it really? Is that anything to do with it? Because, you know, it does look as if the... We were hearing, weren't we, last autumn, before there was any invasion, that these prices were going to be going through the roof.
Well, there is a world energy market, which isn't just the Russian energy supply. But the Russian energy supply was a crucial component, for example, in German industrial competitiveness. And the other thing that's gone, the loss of gas was traditionally shipped through Ukraine. And they haven't, the Russians are at war with the Ukraine, but they haven't cut off the gas supply. Because that would be, you know, that would be the wrong thing to do. They're not trying to destroy everything. They're trying to negotiate. They've been trying to negotiate since 2014.
I don't know if we've got any Sun readers with us today, but this week, earlier on in the week, they printed a fascinating article. Well, I don't know if you've seen this week. I think it was Tuesday's Sun. Which was comparing food prices in Britain and Russia, and looking at how the food prices in here are roughly going up sort of between 20 and 50% for these basic commodities, Martin, and down in Russia by equivalent amounts.
Well, that's because Russia, since 2014 and the first round of sanctions after the coup in Kiev, they stopped buying all EU food products. and that gave a huge market in Russia to, for them to get their food market set up. And they've now become the world's biggest exporter of grain in that period. While they've overtaken the US. And of course, in Russia, they don't have to subsidize it to do that. In the US, they do. And this is a big change. It's one of the reasons why Russia is being so assertive, is because A, they can feed themselves, and B, they're actually feeding the rest of the world, which they didn't used to do. That's a new phenomenon. Certainly during the Soviet era, they had to import food, and they made money from selling oil and gas.
I mean, this is very important, I think, to make this link between energy and food, because if the energy prices are going to go up, there's all sorts of things. For example, the production of fertilizer, cost of the fuel going into the tractors. I'm afraid we don't have many horses pulling ploughs around Europe anymore, so that's going to massively affect the cost to a farmer. In fact, at the agricultural fair that I went to a few weeks ago, the farmers were saying, this is livestock farmers actually saying, well, don't the government want us to be able to feed the public? I mean, this is quite a fundamental factor, isn't it?
From a market point of view, you shouldn't have farming in Britain at all. When in 1888 the Dunedin docked in London docks with frozen lamb from New Zealand cheaper than it could produced in Britain, farming was on the rock. Now, I don't agree with that. Countries should have food security, but you can't get it through having a market. And the same thing with energy security. You can't get it through having a market. What's happened in the gas market is you've now got a spot market where people every day are buying gas futures, which actually makes the price go shooting up. And, of course, previously, when it was all controlled through government agreements, basically, between government-run companies, then that couldn't happen.
Well, let me put it to you that if somebody knew, Martin, that Russia was going to invade Ukraine, they would know that that would have an effect on the international energy market, wouldn't they? And then they could actually bet on that.
Yeah, but that's definitely what's happened. It does happen. It is happening. This is why they are windfall profits. Because if there's a shortage and you're an oligopoly, private oligopoly, you're just going to make money. Electricité de France, on the other hand, is owned by the French government. And guess what? Their energy price increase is going to be 4%.
Well, anyway, last week I spoke to...
Because they can say that they can do that.
I spoke to Barrister Robert Hanson, who's come over here from Hong Kong to live. He couldn't stick it out there, even though he's sort of yearning to go back to Hong Kong. And he had quite a bit to say about this topic of what he thinks is the economic hitmen, which have now turned on the UK. If you remember, there's that book by John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. But he also related this to what he sees, and it'd be interesting to get your take on this, Andy, of how the control of carbon is being used in this too.
It's control of the media, and people have been probably actually quite concerned or scared to say anything that criticises climate change, global warming or low carbon policies. If people say that, they're ridiculed and sort of demeaned by other people if you say that. So people just have to kind of feel they have to go along with it in the work environment, in the social environment, in the media environment. So people just don't speak out against it. But again, the root cause of food has been, well, energy prices increase the cost of transporting food. And again, the policies of the World Economic Forum, United Nations and the Green Groups has been, as you say, to get rid of livestock and also to get fertilizers, which produce carbon emissions off the land. So that reduces the productivity of the land and again, pushes up the prices of food. So again, it's these green policies are causing the problems. Another thing living in Suffolk is I do meet a few farmers and I do talk to them, and they're actually paying something like about £1,000 an acre per year for not growing anything on their land. So there's actually a financial incentive just to buy land, do nothing with it, and get paid. So the policies are all wrong here. There's a classic book out called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And I think it's John Perkins that wrote this a long time ago. And he's got a revised edition out as well. And he was employed by the American government. And he would go into these poorer countries and start large projects, dam building, energy building, construction projects, anything that costs lots and lots of money. And the American government...
You know what, sorry to interrupt you, I'm thinking about HS2, Hinkley C.
Oh, but the nuclear... Yeah, okay, the nuclear power stations. These are also problematic as well. I think there's...
I don't want to divert you. I'm saying, look, you know, yes, you're right. I mean, there are these big, massive, big financial projects going on in the UK right now.
Originally, it was America that was driving companies to debt through large projects. And then when they couldn't pay for them, the American government walked straight in and say, okay, we'll write off all your debt, but we'll own all your assets. What's happening in the UK right now with these big projects, as you say, the Hinkley nuclear power stations, but also the way the government's spending money on just about everything, is it's driving this country into debt. Same in Canada, same in France, same in the Netherlands, so I think same in New Zealand. Debts are increasing, certainly in England. And what I think is happening is what America is doing to those countries, World Economic Forum, United Nations, are doing to England right now. Everything is being driven into debt, and then they will walk in into the UK and say, right, we'll write off all your debt, but we'll own all your assets. That's what's happening here, and this is what Liz Truss is going to bring about. When she's got this energy price cap brought in, it sounds nice, like we've got to cap it, but it's not. What she's doing, she's taking taxpayers' money, and the energy companies are still getting paid for this. They're still receiving income. There's no loss to them. Households get their bills capped, but the government pumping more debt into the economy, and as you have more debt in the economy, these outside bodies, the World Economic Forum, United Nations, their bodies will then take over all the energy companies in the UK. They'll just take them over. This is what's happening in the UK right in front of our eyes.
So that's Robert Hanson, a barrister now in Suffolk, who's a regular. He was our Hong Kong correspondent until he couldn't stay. He felt he couldn't stay in Hong Kong anymore because it was getting too oppressive there, and he's come over now to East Anglia. But anyway, Andy on the line, speaking to us live from London. What do you make of? I mean, he has a bit of a pop at these green policies. I mean, he might be one of those people who's rather glad to see these green levies being dropped by Liz Truss on energy.
I don't really know what he's on about, to be honest, Tony. I mean, he's talking about the UN and the World Economic Forum coming in and taking over things that have been burdened with debt. There's almost nothing left in the UK to be privatised. There's almost nothing left in the UK that can be taken over by anybody because it's already been taken over. That's what's been happening for the last 43 years since Margaret Thatcher got in. It's a kind of absurd thing to say. But I absolutely have no interest in people proposing that there is some conspiracy when it comes to using wind power on land, offshore, using wave power, using the ability of renewable energy, which can be established quite quickly without insane investment, without insane profiteering, to reduce our fossil fuel use, which I believe to be absolutely crucial.
What about just building more of these? Because we've seen, for example, in the United States, which over in California, over the last month or so, the governor there telling people, well, you know, you've got to switch everything off because we don't have actually enough power. Isn't there a danger here that we're building in a system which isn't so resilient as the, I mean, you know, whatever you say about the old fossil fuel, gas powered and coal fired power stations is they worked. They always delivered the energy we needed.
Well, yeah, they did, but unfortunately, what they're doing by that is pumping intolerable amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But even apart from that, Tony, we have reached peak everything. Anyone who's at all critical of the human civilization, such as it is, over the last many decades, we realize that we have exceeded any previous limits on almost everything that we do. We are using energy in a way that if we took a time machine back 50 years, for you and I, Tony, went back to how we were living as children, we would not understand it. We are overusing everything. We may well, as a result of these various crises, have to reduce our use of energy. I think that that's quite sensible. And I think that people who are thinking critically about how we live already understand that. But how you sell that to a public is very difficult because people have been told for 40 years Not that they're being controlled to make profits for companies, but that they are free people who have the choice to do what they want. And they are most particularly told that they will not be told how they can live. They will not be told, for example, whether they should drive their cars less. They will not be told that something should happen to the aviation industry. You can have your agreements or disagreements about how much we should be doing of various things, but nobody is in a position anymore to tell people we've all taken this too far. We need to start reducing every aspect of our overconsumption of the finite resources of a planet and what we're doing to the atmosphere. So I don't know how you go about doing that, but I think that that's important. And I can see from what I'm hearing that other countries around the world are telling their populations that we may have to start reducing our energy use. And the one country that I'm not hearing anything from at the moment is the UK.
Well, you and I are both Londoners, and you probably can remember in the 1980s when Ken Livingstone actually had a policy, and in fact he was elected on the policy, of reducing down, possibly even to zero, the cost of public transport. I can remember also seeing that the first year that that was introduced, I think it was about 1983, there was a reduction in 3,000 in serious accidents on the roads, far, far less use of cars.
In Sheffield as well.
And so the point here really is that there used to be a decent public transport system. You can't just shut this down while we've got, I sometimes stand with Dave as he heads off back on his bus after the show, and a bus will appear, it's about to come, and then it just disappears. It's what they call a ghost bus that never actually existed at all. Even though you're being told a bus is coming, there is no bus. So the system is just, it's a privatised nightmare. Again, this is all seems down to privatisation, and we are trapped in a system where people are actually being trapped into their cars, haven't they?
Well, I think clearly they are in rural settings more than anywhere else, Tony. I don't know about what kind of oversight there is of transport in Bristol. In London, it's quite well coordinated.
It is,
For there to be so many vehicles on the roads, because we have an extraordinary train network and buses. And also, we could be promoting the use of bicycles much more than we are. Cycle riders in London are still, a rarity when you compare it to some other European countries and how far they have advanced with the importance of giving over roads to bicycles rather than vehicles.
Martin, this $2 trillion or so debt, Robert's talking about this massive increase in debt. Does it really matter?
Are we talking about general
the government debt?
Oh, government debt. I thought, because of course Transport for London is also in debt.
Well, I mean, this is the the spin-off from Liz spending $130 billion.
The debts that have been built up since 2008 are because of the bailout of the banking system. And if you're going to follow the John Redwood, Patrick Minford, textbook, then you let the banking system collapse. And all those people who were invested in the banking system lose their money. But of course, the downside of that is possibly all the people who've invested, got their money in the bank, lose their money. And that's why you have to bail it out, too big to fail and all the rest of it. But at that point, the philosophy of free market capitalism has ended. It's ended a long time ago. In actual fact, in reality, the government is underpinning everything. But what they're doing is they're underpinning it as a capitalist simulacrum. So they could do completely different things, since we've already crossed the Rubicon into having a socialist economy, but it's socialism for the rich. And of course, it's a simulacrum which looks and feels like capitalism because, people are still struggling to pay their bills. You could solve that, but to do that means you've got to blast your way out of the mental space. And of course, in 2008, Gordon Brown was forced to nationalise some banks. But the philosophy was always, as soon as possible, we've got to get them back into the private sector to carry on doing the silly stuff that got them into trouble in the first place.
I think it might be nice to just run through some of the outrages there are in these privatised industries. This is somebody on Twitter, I'm not sure quite who, but anyway, pointing out some salaries. But to begin with, profits. British Gas made a profit of $1.3 billion in the 3 months to June this year. BP has announced profits of $7 billion between and the 3 months again to June. Shell, it's profited around about $9.5 billion in a year. The people at the top, John Pettigrew, the boss of the National Grid, he's got a £6.5 million bonus on top of his salary. Chris O'Shea, chief executive of British Gas owner Centrica, was paid. Do you want to have a guess, Esther?
About 300k, do you think?
2 million in okay. salary and benefits. Okay. Scottish Power's chief executive Keith Anderson, he's on 1.15 million. E.ON boss Michael Lewis is on only a paltry £1 million a year. EDF's Simon Rossi is also on £1 million, and their top executives have joined enjoyed a share of 4.65 million bonuses, scattered amongst three or four of those. Peter Simpson of Anglia Water, he earned a 1.3 million last year. Welsh Water boss, 930,000. Seven Trent bosses scattered around 5.56 million amongst their directors. Thames Water's Sarah Bentley got a £727,000 bonus on top of her 2 million salary. Meanwhile, there are people who haven't had breakfast, Martin, or lunch today.
Well, that's right. And it's partly to do with insiders. My friend Adrian and your friend Tony, I actually spoke on the phone this week. His dad used to be the head of British Gas when it was a public institution, and he opposed privatisation, but of course as soon as it was privatised his salary was doubled, because that's what happens if you're in the private sector. And of course Scottish Power, you mentioned there, they are actually owned by the Scottish Government, but no doubt to attract executives in the field they have to offer the sort of money that he could earn if he was going to one of the other privatised utilities, all of which of course has made a lot of money for some people. And it's actually rent extraction from the society. And of course, we're now up against peer competitors like Russia and China who don't believe in that stuff. And that's why they're probably going to win as we go into the next struggle of ideologies. And we're going to lose because the way we do it don't work.
So, Esther, what can you pick out of this argument, and what would you think? What, if you had the ear of the Chancellor, who, by the way, happens to be another member of the Pinay Circle, this far-right think tank, Martin quite rightly said last week was created before the Second World War, what do you think they should be doing? What should their thinking be like?
So within their strategy, there should definitely be a focus on publicly provided renewable energies and a strategy to deliver that very, very quickly. And they should certainly very quickly nationalise Centrica. Relatively small amount of money for that, around $5 billion. They should nationalise the National Grid. So those are very easy
things to do. So Centrica, what do they actually do?
The British Gas, they extract gas and they purchase it. But also they provide gas storage facilities, and the lack of a storage facility has been a reason for the massive price hike in this country in the past year or so.
I know, we used to have these things called gasometers, didn't we? Which contained enormous amounts of gas, didn't we?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but we did lose 70% of our gas storage facilities when Centrica closed down Rough, which needs to be reversed clearly.
From their point of view, that is actually a positive, because when they were nationalised, it made sense to have a spare capacity to keep the price down. If you don't care what the price is, there's no point storing it.
And I think the other thing, Tony, is a change of mindset, because if you look at France, they've totally taken over EDF, as you know. Norway, which provides more than half...
That's right, hang on, just because just a few weeks ago, EDF was... the French government had a golden share in it, but they decided to buy up the whole of the rest of it.
Partly because of issues with nuclear capability that they needed to sort out, but nonetheless, the French government, by the end of September, will own the whole of EDF. Moreover, EDF actually owns some of our stuff. It owns Sizewell B. It's going to have a major share in Sizewell C. So now the French government is going to be determining energy capability and sustainability in the UK. So there is an issue about the mindset and ideology of the current government, which refuses to countenance any sort of public ownership when other countries like France, like Norway, realise it's absolutely the right thing to do for fuel security in their countries.
Now, I understand that there is something called the investor dispute system. I was chatting to the Jen Robinson, who's Julian Assange's barrister, about this, and she's saying this is one of the reasons, Martin, they will not do these nationalisations, is because the foreign investors in these privatised businesses will take them to court.
Yeah, well, a lot of these things are settled in the courts in London. So, for example, the Poles were supplied by the Russians with gas at a stable price, which has been agreed, you know, it's a 20 or 30 year contract. They wanted a few years ago to get out of that contract. So they came to the courts in London, just the same courts that said that Venezuela couldn't have its gold back and all the rest of it. And those courts found in favour of Poland and they were able to get out of the contract. Then, of course, the price of gas rose through the roof. So it was actually a totally stupid thing for them to do. And, of course, they're still physically dependent on some gas from Russia. I mean, we're obviously come to discuss all this, you know, the geopolitics of gas later on, because it's more to do with economic theory, what we're chewing through at the moment. But it is, you know, if you do stupid stuff for decades, you end up in a mess, don't you? It's pretty obvious.
We're going to hear now a vox pop from Liverpool as to what the Liverpool people think or thought last week of the cost of living crisis, how to solve it, and what to make of these energy price hikes.
Well, we've been given this £350, which I think is just hush money, basically, so the Tories can say, look, we've given you something, now get on with it. But it doesn't touch the sides. That might cover, like, a month. Or, you know, if I'm really conservative and spend time in someone else's house, you know, to try and pool resources, then it might last a couple of months. But it's not going to get me through the winter.
I'm sick, fed up of the dross of this country at the moment. And that last 6 weeks. And Madame Truss, oh my God, you know. I mean, she hasn't got functioning brain cells, which has been very evident if you've watched any of the hustings, because she's just making it up on the hoof. And what's happening, you know, with Enough is Enough. I'm a councillor in Sefton, and I'm really worried about the people in Sefton that are going to be, you know, really struggling, because they're struggling at the moment. They've been struggling for months. And there's no help, nothing, nobody cares. All we're bothered about is putting money into rich people's pockets. They don't care about any of us, you know, so that's why I'm here.
We're supporting Enough is Enough, we're supporting the cost of living crisis that we're in at the moment. And by people coming out on the streets now, that's what it shows, doesn't it? That we're not happy and we need something done, we need change. And Enough is Enough, it seems to have just come from nowhere, and people want to back it, because I don't think we had anything. I think we felt a bit lost that nobody was there representing us, and Enough is Enough has come out now, and it seems to be the thing to back at the moment.
So that's Liverpoolians there giving their point of view. Joining us, just to wind up, Andy, if you don't mind, on the line there, down in London. Could you give us a sum up what you make of the actual problems that we've been having with energy? What can we do? What should we do?
I think what Esther was talking about was very important, Tony, which is to identify which are the aspects of the energy industry that can be brought into public control to start removing the profiteering. Everything that's been happening recently, it's interesting because we've been talking about water. So we've not only been looking at the energy crisis, but water is so absurd. When I found out that the head of Thames Water is on $2 million a year and watching this company pumping sewage into, you know, off every beach available, it's such an example of how privatization has failed. And I think some of the popular movements that are going on at the moment, from the unions and from people calling for change, What's really at the heart
of it? Well, there is something called can't pay, won't pay, isn't there?
Yeah.
Which is where people are now registering. People are registering online. Sorry, Andy, I just want to explain basically what it is. People are registering online saying that at a certain point they're just simply going to stop paying their energy bills.
Yeah. Yeah, well, exactly. And I think, you know, I think that's it. I think it's the cumulative effect of realizing that all of the privatization that we were sold as giving us choice was a lie. And that everywhere we look, it has been ruinous for the people of this country. And I just saw in the FT today an article that is saying that countries in Eastern Europe, the living standards of ordinary people are set to be better than the living standards of British people within the next few years. As with the States, because the rich are phenomenally rich in our countries, but the poor people's poverty in our countries is getting more and more and more extreme. You know, and the inequality in our societies is something that I just hope it won't stand for much longer. I think there is a huge and understandable existential anger building up at the way that we have been so blatantly ripped off for the whole of our adult lifetimes, Tony.
But the Brits don't tend to come out on the streets and demonstrate that much, do they? Do we?
Well, not up till now, shall we say, Tony, but how far do you push people? And I think this government, I'm hoping that the government of Liz Truss is going to be the last straw, because these are dangerously fanatical, far-right libertarian ideologues. They have no interest in us at all.
Interested
in profits.
Well, they surely they are sitting there a bit like they were in the 1980s during the miners' strike, thinking, actually, this is a battle. We can provoke the unions to come out on strike during the winter, etc., but we can beat them and we can smash them in the process.
The problem is, Tony, that 40 years ago, Thatcher was promoting liberalisation as the way to, you know, increase the wealth of the country and the well-being of everybody. That's what I'm saying. 40 years on, privatisation has failed. Everybody knows that. There is simply nothing that they can offer that will benefit the people of this country. Nothing. All they are doing is further enriching the rich. I mean, removing the cap on bankers' bonuses today, really. Is that the best that you can do? This is going to stimulate growth. The failed notion of the trickle-down system. No, I think it's. I think they will be shown to be as lacking in vision as they are, and that is going to provoke anger that I don't think we've seen for a long time.
Yeah, maybe. You know, rubbing people's noses in it is not the best tactic to win hearts and minds.
Yes,
anyway, Andy, can you just tell listeners whereabouts they can find your work, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, find me at andyworthington.co.uk. That's my website, and that's where I discuss Guantanamo, British political issues, all kinds of stuff.
Maybe you could just, I keep saying this, but finish up by talking about Guantanamo a little bit, because we've got Farouk here, who's ex-Bristol Muslim Cultural Society, now Bristol Pakistan Society.
Yes, well, you know, Guantanamo is somewhere I've been writing about and campaigning to get closed for, what are we on now, 16 and a half years. The prison's been open for you know, nearly 21 years. It'll be 21 years in January. And, you know, throughout that time, I think the efforts of people who care have been chipping away very, very, very slowly at a system that doesn't care. You know, the U.S., whoever's in charge in the U.S., if they're Democrats, they know that it's wrong. If they're Republicans, they love the idea of it. And it has taken such a long time to get to a point where the end of the prison is in sight.
So, I mean, are there still people, inmates in there?
There are 36 men still held at Guantanamo, Tony. And only 10 of those are currently facing charges. So, you know, these include the notorious individuals who are allegedly responsible for the 9/11 attacks, other people responsible allegedly for terrorist attacks. But even with just 36 men still held there, the majority of those men still held never had any kind of leadership position. Many of them never had any involvement with any terrorist organization, Al-Qaeda or otherwise. They are simply foot soldiers who were in Afghanistan before 9/11 fighting an inter-Muslim civil war with the Northern Alliance. Then afterwards, they morphed instantly after 9/11 into terrorists. and they've been held at Guantanamo ever since. And for these people in these, you know, lowly positions who should have been prisoners of war protected by the Geneva Conventions, some of them are held simply because they've had a bad attitude while they've been at Guantanamo. They have resisted the injustice of their imprisonment without charge or trial and the brutality to which they've been subjected for 20 years. And they are therefore perceived as a security threat. I mean, it's an extraordinary topsy-turvy Kafkaesque world, even to this day, even with just 36 men still held. And so I suppose the hopeful part of the story, Tony, is that since President Biden got in, he's been approving some of these men who've never been charged for release. And with the situation that he's now got almost nobody that he's holding there, that if they're not been charged, then they're still being held with no intention of releasing them. He's unfortunately moving very slowly in actually releasing people. But in terms of moving in the right direction, we're in the best place we've been.
Well, Obama said he was going to shut it down, but he didn't. Anyway, Farouk, this is something you've been dealing with for a long time.
Thanks to Andy for his hard work. You probably know Mazen Beg. Close friend of mine. We were in Bosnia together, and we when the Bosnian War happened, and we were taking aid across from here to Bosnia-Herzegovina. He ended up then, obviously, in Albania, and then from there he ended up in Islamabad for a little bit and then moved across into Kabul where he became a teacher. And he moved back into Islamabad when the war started, and he was arrested by what was then Guns for Hire, the Pakistani ISI, and they arrested him, handed him over to the Americans in Kabul. I think he ended up in Bagram. And then from there he was shipped off to Guantanamo, completely innocent.
We had Ben Griffin, I believe, the former SAS soldier on this program, talking about how he was told, well, just basically arrest anyone that looks like a Muslim and we will fit them up.
They were paid money. So the incentive was, if you could give us money, certainly to the Pakistani security services, we'll pay you money the more people that you can hand over to us.
Just imagine, Martin, if that had been Jewish people that were being arrested randomly at gunpoint because they were Jews.
Well, yes. I mean, lots of things to be said about, double standards in all of this stuff. It's interesting that you say that you're in Bosnia. Well, I was in Bosnia-Herzegovina working for CAFWD.
Right.
And, of course, we used to cooperate with Islamic Relief.
Yep.
And, lots of... lots of people really don't understand how complex these things can be, like the Ukraine, for example.
Absolutely.
Far more complex than people realise.
Absolutely.
Well, this is what we're here to actually explain it. The BBC's not here for that. They do talk in a rather superficial fashion. I remember living in Northern Ireland and being amazed at how much better the Northern Irish BBC was at explaining the troubles than the network TV and network radio over here. Anyway, Andy Worthington, thanks for sticking with us. Thanks very much for all your help and aid to assist our discussion and understanding of these matters. And I will put up a link to your article about this energy price guarantee, so-called, that Liz Truss has managed to bury in the most spectacular fashion by the Queen dying on the same day as it was all announced.
Yeah.
So thanks very much for joining us. Now,
well, it's been great, Tony. Thanks very much. Hope to talk again soon.
Nice one. Thank you. Maybe we should just wind up to pick up on this aspect, because I mean you're from the Pakistan community here. It'd be lovely to hear actually what people are making. There's two major things, obviously. There's firstly the floods, which I'm hoping are dying down now. It's obviously the Queen has knocked all this stuff off the headlines, but we were seeing this last week, particularly the horrific floods in Pakistan. But then also, of course, the political situation with Imran Khan. So take it in whichever direction you wish, Farouk.
Yeah, you want me to start now? Okay, so let's start right at the beginning. It is a little bit complex. I'll come on to the floods afterwards. But if we go back to Imran Khan's government, he was in power for just under 4 years. And in that time, you had 2 years of COVID. So let's have a look at what he did. In those 2 years, literally, of him being in power, he'd raised record exports. He'd raised record harvests. Now, for a country whose economy is agricultural based, 70 years in existence, and it comes to him being in power that you have the record harvest of production in that country. What does that show you is that he actually had a plan. His government actually cared about the people. He inaugurated No One Should Sleep Hungry at Night program. People that were manual labor coming from the villages into the cities, he set up sanctuaries for them, provided two meals a day. You would sleep there, so there was nobody he wanted to sleep rough on the streets. If you went to Islamabad or any of the major cities, Lahore, anywhere like that, you would see people sleeping under bridges on the streets. All of that stopped under him. So he inaugurated policies that were genuine for the people, and there was widespread support. Widespread support, except in the media. Now, all of a sudden, in October 2021, you suddenly saw a massive campaign in the media of all the channels, apparently talking about the massive cost of living, etc., 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 and how inept and inexperienced Pakistani government, this new government was. If you have a look at what was then, I think it was around 8% was the inflation rate. And the coverage on the media, somebody's actually done how much coverage they gave on the media, it was around 30 to 40% of nightly news was covering inflation rates, cost of living crisis, etc. It was 8%. Now, since he's been gone, it's at 30-something percent, and the coverage is on around 3 to 4%. Yeah, so you start off with a massive media. We were talking about the confessions of an economic hitman. This is how it works. You and I know this is how it works. When you want a regime change operation, this is how it works. So what was it about Imran Khan that was people finding difficult? And it was everything we're talking about here today. He was anti-privatization of the industries, of the national industries, of the railways, of all of that. What he wanted to do was keep them, the gas, all the reserves, everything he wanted to keep under national control, the national airlines, everything. And this obviously upset quite a few people who wanted to privatize all that. The previous governments were talking about privatization. And then all of a sudden, I think it was in February 2022, oh, suddenly the big question mark. In October 21, what also started happening was the American ambassador to Pakistan suddenly started meeting Imran Khan's coalition government, members of Imran Khan's coalition government. So members of his own party were seen coming in and out of the ambassador's residence. People started asking questions. What have you got to talk about? What did you talk about? Oh, we just had dinner. Oh, we just had this. There were 20 people that were photographed coming in and out. Those 20 people, coincidentally, 4 months later, tabled a no-confidence motion against Prime Minister Imran Khan. In addition to that, Undersecretary of State for America, Donald Liu, actually wrote, there's a set of minutes with the Pakistani ambassador to the U.S., where he directly threatens the Imran Khan government, and he says to the ambassador, Pakistani ambassador, remove Imran Khan through a no-confidence motion, which hadn't been tabled at the time, and you'll be forgiven, i.e. the opposition will be forgiven, who were corrupt. Coincidentally, a few days later, literally, a no-confidence motion is tabled, and it proves to be successful. Now, even the opposition, who is now in government, will tell you that a no-confidence motion has never been successful in Pakistan unless the army supports that no-confidence motion. So suddenly you have all this going on. Imran Khan is suddenly removed from power. But just before he's removed from power, what happens? The key is that Imran Khan goes and visits Vladimir Putin in Russia on the day that he declares the invasion of the war starts in Ukraine. Imran Khan was told to leave. I don't go ahead with the meeting because he's just declared war. Imran Khan turned around and said, well, actually, I'm here, and he says this on record, he says, I'm here for the people of Pakistan. I'm not here for Europe. I'm not here for anyone else. I'm here for Pakistan. This is what we've agreed to come here for, was to discuss, coincidentally, buying cheap gas, cheap oil, and grain. And that was the reason I'm here to, that's what we're here to discuss. And I'm going to continue to discuss that and see if we can agree a good deal, which is what we came to agree. He agreed a good deal, half price of the international rates at the time. Imran Khan goes back and finds a no confidence motion tabled against him, which he then goes on to lose. Since being removed from power, Imran Khan's popularity has gone through the roof. So it was a massive miscalculation by the powers that be.
Well, it's not a miscalculation, surely, because he doesn't hold the strings of power anymore.
He doesn't, but
a pop star could be popular, but they haven't got power.
Right. No, good point. But in reality, all of what's happened now is in February, up to February, you couldn't find anyone worth his salt being critical of the Pakistani army. You couldn't find it. Anyone who criticized the Pakistani army was seen as a traitor to the state. Now, the Pakistani army has been dragged through the dirt. Everyone now knows what the scenario is, who actually controls power, what the situation is, what it was that Imran Khan had done, who he had upset, and the people that have been brought in. So who's been brought in? It's a coalition of 13 opposition parties, basically the entire spectrum of the opposition against Imran Khan. All of the parties, for the first time in the history of Pakistan, so that's the Noon League, which is Nawaz Sharif, and the PPP, which is the Benazir Bhutto's party, or supposedly, and 13 other, including religious parties, are all in part of that coalition. Now, do they have any credibility? These people don't even agree on the price of a color of the wallpaper, let alone anything else. These people are diametrically opposed to each other, and yet somehow they're all sat together as part of a coalition, which is impossible. You don't have the same ideas, you don't have the same vision, you don't have the same ethos. Your politics are opposed. And yet here they are all sat together, and they're surviving by two votes. So the government could fall any day if two people withdrew. Somehow, two people aren't being withdrawn from the government. Somebody's keeping that glue. And that is widely tipped to be the Pakistani army.
Well, one of the great things about being popular, as Imran Khan is, as well as a politician, you don't often hear people using those two expressions together, but it is that he can attract potentially a massive audience in rallies and on the television.
And that's exactly what he's been doing. I mean, he's 70 years old, and he's doing daily rallies across the country. And when I say daily rallies, I'm talking about, 50, 60, 70,000 people are attending these rallies on a daily basis. It's got so bad that now he's been barred from appearing on television. So you can't broadcast his speeches live on television. They have to be recorded and edited. His chief of staff has been arrested, tortured in prison. Any journalist who tries to report what Imran Khan has said has been arrested. Two of them have had to leave the country. One is now currently in Canada. One is in the United Kingdom. This is turning into a desperate coalition, is turning into a fascist government. So they're shutting down. So ARY, which was the most popular TV channel in Pakistan, was shut down because it kept showing Imran Khan's rallies. Shut down. As soon as that was shut down, the channel that was showing Imran Khan's rally was Ball TV, which was sixth in the ratings. Suddenly that shot up to number one. That became the number one TV channel in Pakistan. Now they've just shut that down a couple of days ago.
What about the YouTubes and people like that?
So the YouTube, again, everything was going well on YouTube. And again, last week, highest ratings, his rallies were through YouTube. People switched, obviously, to social media and alternative media. And then last week, when he was broadcasting live, suddenly YouTube went off the air, started slowing down or was slowed down. So now they've even targeted YouTube. So every time he speaks, whenever he's broadcasting, he's got his own channels now and everything. So whenever he's broadcasting on those channels, the alternative media, his own media, now they're just shutting down the entire internet when he's broadcasting. What doesn't make sense is, hold on, even if you stopped his live broadcasts, as soon as you turn the internet back on, people are going to upload his speech and download his speech again. Our prime minister, the Pakistani prime minister, Shahbaz Sharif, he decided to do his speech the same time Imran Khan was doing a rally. I kid you not. And his YouTube popularity, the people watching YouTube, was 4,500 at one stage. That was his height. At the same time, Imran Khan's was on 94,000. That's the level of popularity that Imran Khan currently enjoys. The Pakistani government, the actual federal government, now only controls Islamabad. It's like the city of London, basically, because it has its own government popularity there, control there. Every other state, the five states in Pakistan, are all controlled, bar one, by Imran Khan's parties or people allied to him. So the current Pakistani government only has a 27-kilometer square area of control. Literally, that's all it has. Now, Imran Khan is saying, I don't want to close down Pakistan, but if you keep pushing me the way you have... So the other day, they charged him with terrorism. Imran Khan, and what did he say in one of his speeches? He turned around because his chief of staff, who was tortured by the police, came before the judge. Torture is supposed to be illegal in Pakistan, and the lady judge handed him back to the police that was torturing him, which is illegal. So as soon as you've noticed signs of torture, the judge cannot hand them back to the police force. It has to go to an alternative secure venue, jail. You can't hand him back to the... Basically, can't have a custodial sentence. So what the judge did, having seen torture and having first said torture has taken place, suddenly, 12 hours later, turned around and handed that Shahbaz Gill back to the police federation that had tortured him. Now, that was illegal. And Imran Khan turned around and said, I will take legal action against the judge for doing that because she broke Pakistani law. Because he said that, that was the statement they used to charge him with terrorism. And their justification is he's terrorizing the judges. Now, it's a mockery. And as it's going through the justice system now, and even the judges are now saying, you're making a mockery of the terrorism law in Pakistan, that you're charging someone. Has he carried a bomb? Has he threatened anyone physically, violently? None of that. But he is still, they're pursuing the terrorism charge against him. That's how desperate they have the current system in power has become.
So now, I mean, a Pakistani friend of mine was saying that he thought that there was almost like an element in Pakistan at the moment of the floods almost being an act of God on the horrific political situation in the background.
Yeah, so people are saying that because it's, if you see something, there's a verse in the Quran that if you start to see natural disasters or an increase in natural disasters, it's because there's injustice in the land. Yeah, so that's a sign of injustice in the land. Now, in reality, of course, it is what we're seeing, the floods, is just a successive series of governments who have just completely mismanaged the resources. So we haven't built enough dams. The people weren't evacuated. Even on this occasion, the Pakistani Meteorological Society had said that the monsoons would be much longer in duration and they would be much heavier. I think it's four times what they would normally be. And the government took absolutely no action, didn't evacuate villages, didn't put in sandbags or anything like that, didn't prepare, didn't warn anyone. And what you saw was just a massive deluge and massive devastation. I mean, the devastation is, and we look at Cornwall or a place like that where you get flash flooding. Imagine the whole of the United Kingdom underwater. That's exactly the size in Pakistan that is currently underwater as we speak. And because the soil was absolutely baked, we're not expecting those floodwaters to die down for months. I mean, that is hard soil underneath. It's going to take quite some time for those floodwaters to die down. And the reaction from the federal government, the current government, I mean, because they're not interested. They're just barely holding on to power. They're doing everything they can to hold on to power. They've done nothing. And when I say they've done nothing, all they've done is photo opportunities. There's video evidence after video evidence after video evidence. They come down. Here is Sindh, for example, which is the state most affected by the floods. You see government people setting up a camp, so-called camp. They invite selected refugees to come to these camps. They take pictures of them handing out some food. And then as soon as the pictures are over, you've got normal people videoing this, and they're just packing up the relief camps and just going off to the next place to get a next photo opportunity. So they're not interested in this at all. Imran Khan has done two telethons. The government hasn't done any. He's raised equivalent of $20 million per night. So he's about $40 million in 2 hours, two-hour telethons. The Pakistani government hasn't raised anything, hasn't even done the equivalent of a telethon. And what they did in the second telethon, can you believe? They blacked out his telethon. That's how desperate they are, that not only are they not doing anything for the people themselves, they're actually stopping anyone else from taking action to help those people. So anyone listening now, whatever you do, if you're donating to Pakistani floods, don't give it to the government, because they're honestly not interested, and no one is giving to the government. The government refuses to say how much money they've actually got. And they're refusing to do telethons because they know nobody's going to give them money. That's how inept and completely irrelevant they are at the moment.
But I know many Pakistanis, probably more than British, are very politicised. They do follow the politics of their country very closely. How do you think this situation with Imran Khan is going to resolve itself?
Well, there's two. People have been talking about they may assassinate him. That's a possibility. It's happened before. He could be arrested. He could be charged. This terrorism charge could be pushed all the way through the end. And other charges where they could ban him from politics. That's a possibility.
So they're trying to basically make him a fugitive in his own country that he really should be president of.
Exactly. And he's basically got no assets abroad. So he's saying, if you want to fight me, I'm going to fight. I've got nowhere. I'm not going to run away like the opposition, where they've got flats in Avonfield, the most popular, you know, most expensive flats in London and things like that. He's got none of that. All of his assets are in Pakistan, and he's turned around and he said, if you want to kill me, I'm ready to kill, fight me and kill me. Arrest me, put me away in prison for life. I've got nowhere. I'd rather die than live under your government. Yeah. But what he has done, and what he says he's done, he says his job is done. He's woken up the Pakistani public, and the Pakistani public is now just waiting for his call. If he turns around tomorrow and Imran Khan says, right, come down to Islamabad, we're shutting it down, millions, literally millions would be on the march. And they tried it on May the 25th. He gave a call, and he said, we're going to shut down Islamabad. And what the Pakistani government, with the support of the army, did in shutting down those, I mean, they blocked the roads, they used tear gas, they cut up roads, can you believe, mixed glass with the tarmac and re-tarmacked the roads, the bridges, so you couldn't cross over. I mean, that's the level of trying to suppress the Pakistani public. And if Imran Khan had given the call that just keep coming, he turned around, he arrived in Islamabad, he actually got through, they broke through, the public broke through all their defences, all the barricades, and the people arrived. And he turned around and he goes, the people were so angry, I did see people ready to fight. They had weapons, they had everything. And he goes, as soon as I saw that, I said, no, I do not want a civil war in Pakistan. And he turned around and he goes, take the people back. And people were upset with him because people were ready to fight. They were going to storm the federal buildings. And he said he didn't want to turn it into a Sri Lanka at the moment. Leave it. I'm going to give these people a warning. So they withdrew. The people didn't withdraw for a couple of days, but Imran Khan withdrew, went back to his Panigala, his place in Islamabad. So that's a situation that's very precarious. And Imran Khan yesterday has turned around and goes, I'm at the end now. So if I give the call, it will be the final call.
Well, I think it's fascinating you bringing up Sri Lanka, isn't it? Because they also, at the United Nations, spelt it out that they did not, they were not opposed to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. They saw it as actually a NATO coup from 2014, and they're saying, well, actually, the Russians can't put up with these fascist elements on their borders and the continuous shelling of the Donbass, for example.
And the vast majority of Pakistanis, the public, I have to say, would agree. If you see Imran Khan's rallies, they're waving Russian flags at his rallies. Now, he's asking them not to wave those flags, but they are waving Russian flags at the rallies. Now, whether the Pakistanis are aware of what's going on in the world or what, or whatever, but they seem to have suddenly woken up to what's happening around the world. And what they're saying, and what Imran Khan is saying, is all he's trying to do is put Pakistan first. For the first time in its history, all he wants to do is Pakistan first. He goes, we fought the American war in Afghanistan. It cost us 80,000 lives. And all we got from the Western government is do more. Nobody sacrificed that many people of war they had nothing to do with. And he says he's not going to do it again. He's not going to get involved in anyone else's war. The Russian war, he said, is nothing to do with us.
Well, King Charles III's mentor, Mountbatten, left the whole situation with India and Pakistan in rather an awkward, some said, say deliberately, in Kashmir.
Yeah, deliberately. Kashmir is that cause that stops India and Pakistan from being the best of buddies. We share culture, we share language, we share history. The only issue that exists between India and Pakistan, even the politics are the same. The only issue that we have is how do you resolve the Kashmir issue? Now, Pakistan's version is that we should go by what the UN has promised, which is a vote, let the people in Kashmir decide who they want to be with, whether they want to be with Pakistan, whether they want to be with India, or whether they want to be independent. That's what Imran Khan's now added to that publicity. He's saying that I'll even accept the fact that if they want to be independent, we'll let them be independent. You organize a vote in your section, we'll organize a vote in our section, call it a day. The difference is that the Indian-occupied Kashmir has currently got 600,000 Indian soldiers stationed just in Kashmir. Just in Kashmir, which is just slightly bigger than Wales, yeah? So just imagine that. Pakistan's full standing army is around 600,000. India has more troops, 630-something thousand troops, stationed just in Kashmir alone. So you have to think about the occupation level. It's like,
well, what are these soldiers doing? They're not directing the traffic, are they?
No, they're not. They are suppressing a freedom struggle. Anybody that speaks up, anyone that tries to speak up, anyone that tries... It's basically checkpoint to checkpoint. It's just like what Israel is doing to Palestine. It's exactly the same thing. The other thing, by the way, Imran Khan is being busted for is that the army wants to recognize Israel. And he's saying, I refuse to recognize Israel until it gives the Palestinians their rights. If we give up the Palestinians, if we recognize Israel and say, right, we'll recognize Israel, then we're giving up Kashmir because the exact same thing is happening in Kashmir. So if we acknowledge that Israel has a right over Palestine, then we acknowledge that India has a right over Kashmir, and that cannot be the case.
Martin, you wanted to chip in.
I was just saying, one of the things that happened is after he was removed, you remember there was a drone strike that went in to Kabul and supposedly killed, I can't remember the name of the guy.
Sawari.
Who was an Al-Qaeda operative, supposedly. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I don't believe any
of
that.
Was this during the US withdrawal?
That's after the withdrawal, because what Biden wanted to do is you know, they're being very vindictive towards Afghanistan.
Yeah.
They won't release, we were talking earlier about the refusing to give the Venezuelans their gold back.
Yeah.
They're not, you know, the Central Bank of Afghanistan has got assets, and they've just been seized by the Americans.
Yeah, $10 billion.
That's $300 billion worth of Russia's assets.
Yep. They've just
taken this is what they do. They are criminals.
Literally.
Criminals.
You're absolutely right.
And of course, I don't necessarily believe the story about what happened there, because they make stuff up. You know, I mean, the Taliban are saying, well, we had no evidence that he was there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. you've sent him. But of course, that drone strike had to come in over Pakistani territory.
Yeah.
And I think if Imran Khan had been the president, he would have just said no.
He did. That's right.
And therefore, it's one of the reasons for, you know, that's just the Americans rubbing everybody's nose into it, isn't
There's
it?
There's actually t-shirts now because of what he said. He said absolutely not. When he was asked on television, American television, would you allow American bases or would you write flyover rights to American military? And he turned around and said, absolutely not. I wouldn't do it. I would never allow that. Because we're partners with the United States in peace, but I refuse point blank to be partners with America in any war. End
of. This brings us back to what happened in the 1980s, where you had essentially a military government in Pakistan, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And
they were in charge. And they were, of course, you know, in cahoots with the Americans in what was going on in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Where Al-Qaeda was created, Mujahideen were brought in from all over the world, and all the rest of it.
Absolutely.
And I was talking to a Pakistani taxi driver here in Bristol about all of these things, not in the same detail as you just... Yeah. And I was just... you probably know who General Gul is, who used to head the ISI.
Hamid Gul,
Soon after...
ISI being the Intelligence
Services. Inter-Services.
Inter-Services Initiative.
The Inter-Services Intelligence Agency.
That's right. It's the equivalent of the CIA, basically.
But of course, after the 9/11 attack, General Gul said, well, it's pretty obvious the Americans did this.
Yeah.
And everybody in Pakistan knows that this is the former head of the ISI saying the Americans did this.
Yeah.
And all I feel like saying to General Gul is, and yes, and you were in their pocket all those years.
Yeah.
What about that?
Yeah. Well, he was, although he was the head of the ISI, he was vehemently anti-US. He was.
Yeah.
And then they refused to allow him. He should have been the next chief of army staff.
Yeah, so he's a bit of a maverick.
Yeah, so they refused to allow him to become the next chief of army staff. But His understanding of the geopolitics of the region was quite revealing. And if you look back on some of the stuff he said, it's like, well, he turned out to be absolutely 100% correct. But you're right. What's happened now, exactly like the Pakistani army was during the Al-Qaeda days, it appears that one of the reasons for removing Imran Khan was that the relationship between the American military and the Pakistani military goes back to where it was previously. Yeah. Now, during Imran Khan's tenure, the 3.5, just under 4 years, not a single drone strike took place either in Pakistan or in Kabul during his time in power because he refused to allow it. Not one. As soon as he was removed, within 2 days, there was a drone strike, as you said, in the not only in Kabul,
but
inside Pakistan as well, on the Swat Valley, what they were known as the non-tribal areas, which has now become part of Pakistan. What Imran Khan had told his army, famous or infamously, whatever you want to look at, is he said, if an American drone flies over Pakistan, and he gave an interview to television saying, I've given the authority to shoot it down. Yeah? That has never happened before in the history of Pakistan that the Pakistani army would say we will shoot down an American drone.
Well, there's a lesson for the Brits there, maybe, that we shouldn't be allowing the United States to be having bases like Menwith Hill here, the spy base Menwith Hill, and also, of course, Fairford, just up the road in Gloucestershire, where they based the bombers that were bombing Iraq, Kosovo, etc., and these big bases, Martin, in East Anglia, Lake and Heath, Mildenhall, places like that.
Well, that was a very, very interesting summary of what's happening in Pakistan, Farouk. But of course, as you know, Pakistan isn't the only country in crisis.
Yeah.
This is a global crisis.
Yeah.
And of course, there tends to be a parochialism. You know, people in Britain have a British cost of living, isn't it terrible?
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, it's actually, this is a global, crisis.
Absolutely.
As a result of all the bad decisions that have been taken in my, I'm 62.
Yeah.
It's in my lifetime that all these stupid decisions have been taken.
Yeah.
We used to have a mixed economy in this country.
Yeah.
That's what we grew up with.
Yeah.
You know, so we used to. I left Oxford University in 1980 without a penny of debt.
Yeah.
And all my education had been paid for.
Yeah.
All the way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's all gone.
But you know what's different now? What I see, and certainly in Pakistani politics, is for the first time since I've ever been aware, is that the people are waking up.
Yeah.
220 million people. 80% by the latest survey, 80 to 82%, depending on who you look at, currently are supporting Imran Khan, regardless of the massive propaganda, the shutdown in politics, media, the arrest, intimidation of journalists, all of that, and complete lack of infrastructure of the state in across the country. So if you support the government, you'll get help. If you don't support the government, you won't get help. And the people are turning around on video now and saying, even when the aid is coming, who's given this aid? And one person to, well, this is from the state. Well, if it's from the state, we don't want it.
Yeah,
send it back.
Well, you remember when Osama bin Laden was supposedly assassinated in Abbottabad, what I call the Abbottabad incident.
Yeah.
I don't believe that either. I don't believe any of that. But of course, because we've got pictures of the Americans of Obama supposedly watching the live raid.
Yeah.
And then they subsequently said there was no live feed. So this was all just theatre.
Yeah.
I mean, but anyway, of course, they were using so-called vaccine teams,
ID
teams coming to vaccinate the children.
That's right.
As their way to stake out the compound where
they were getting the DNA. DNA, and as a result of the fact of doing that, what they ended up doing, so using what was supposed to be for the people, they were using those polio vaccination camps, which were encouraging people to come forward and get vaccinated for polio, which is a problem in Pakistan. It turned out they were using that to get the DNA of all the people in the area where they said they thought he was to get a certain people. And eventually that's how they found it.
But
people turned against the doctors that were providing polio vaccinations. So now in those tribal regions, you cannot deliver polio vaccinations to the people because they mistrust them, because they see it's a CIA
you
program.
See, these are all of these, intended and unintended consequences of these evil machinations, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, anyway, what we've been talking about is largely Michael Hudson's stuff, isn't it? I mean, the idea that some parts of the world have finance capitalism ruling, where money basically is God, and money can buy you, it can buy you a television station, money can buy you a government, it can bribe you a politician, it can buy you a lawyer, it can bribe and buy you a judge, it can buy you a military.
Yeah.
In fact, political party. Why doesn't the money just buy you a political party? And on the other side of the divide is the people who go for these traditional mixed economy, what Michael Hudson calls industrial capitalism. And I just found that interview that he did, and we played, I think I put a link up to it on last week's show as well, so enlightening as to this, what's really going on in Ukraine is actually one of the front lines in this battle between these two different systems. One is where you vote for a government that actually organises the infrastructure of the country to benefit the nation, and the other one where you're voting for, it doesn't matter who you vote for, because actually both sides are in the pay of the City of London, Wall Street, and the financial system, because they buy everything up that opposes them. Last week we talked about it, but we didn't actually have a clip. I looked all over the internet to try and find a clip of Putin's speech to the Eastern equivalent of the World Economic Forum, which is called the Eastern Economic Forum, which took place last week in Vladivostok. To try and find an English translation was impossible. So you know what I did? I put some subtitles on it and I voiced it up myself. So here is me being Vladimir Putin, giving a short extract of his speech that he gave to the Eastern Economic Forum, which I think is very enlightening about where obviously, China and the East is on the up. They're doing very well economically. And, of course, this is one of the reasons why the United States is getting annoyed and getting angry and threatening countries, because it is going down. I've already mentioned that the entire system of international relations has recently undergone irreversible tectonic shifts. Emerging states and regions around the world, primarily, of course, in the Asia-Pacific region, now play a substantially bigger role. Asia-Pacific countries emerged as new centres of economic and technological growth, attracting human resources, capital, and manufacturers. Despite all that, Western countries are seeking to preserve yesterday's world order that benefits only them and forces everyone to live according to the rules which they themselves made up. They are also the ones who regularly violate those rules, always changing them to suit their agenda. The refusal of other countries to subjugate themselves to this diktat forces Western elites to lose their grip and make short-sighted, irrational decisions on global security, politics, and economics. All these decisions run counter to the interests of all countries and people, including the people in Western countries. The gap separating the Western elites from their own citizens is widening. Europe is about to throw its manufacturing base, the quality of life of its people, and socio-economic stability into the sanctions furnace, depleting its potential, as directed by Washington, in the name of the infamous Euro-Atlantic unity. In fact, this amounts to sacrifices for the sake of preserving the dictatorship of the United States in global affairs. Well, I don't think the dictatorship of the United States is really going to be sustained very much longer, because more and more people, as you've just been talking about in Pakistan, are saying, well, actually, we don't want to be bossed around by the Americans. We're losing our respect for them fast. But on the economic side of what he's saying there, Esther, he's saying what everybody seems to know, except the BBC, that the sanctions were a waste of time. They've completely backfired. They've ended up with astronomical fuel and food prices here in the West, and in Russia, the people are all patting Putin on the back because he's brought the price of many staples, things like basic things like meat and potatoes, down something like 20%.
Yeah, we in the West are paying for the sanctions on Russia, clearly. And while you were speaking, I was thinking, well, when is somebody going to mention the CIA? Because you look at the parallels, don't you, between the maiden coup in 2014.
Yeah, this is in Kiev,
happening, yeah. Yeah, and what's happening now in Pakistan. You look what's happening in South America and the interventions there of the CIA, and you think, are these parallels? Am I imagining this?
100%. Well, then they are all of these things are related, and of course we're now in a global, we do in fact have a conversation going on a global level which wasn't there before, which is, you know, all to the positive. I mean, in particular, I was on RT for 8 years, and of course they've been banned by BBC, and I did a couple of interviews for them after the ban, but then they've stopped phoning me because I think the audience has just been completely knocked out.
Mm. Well, they've got a much, much smaller operation in Moscow now.
Right. They had to close the office. 24/7.
I don't think it's anything personal, Martin.
I'm just saying that you're talking about closing down TV stations. Yeah. That's what's happened here. Yeah. And one of the things I said in 2018, there was a court case in Kiev where the Berkut riot police were put on trial supposedly for shooting down the demonstrators in the Maidan Square. Mm. There were the Holy Hundred, they called them, and they were all shot, and the coup took place, and the Berkut riot police were arrested, and they said, you were the people who did this. They put them on trial, and to their great credit, the courts in Kiev threw it out. And the reason they threw it out is because they had live testimony from two guys in Georgia said, no, we were the snipers. There were 50 of us brought in from Georgia, and we shot all of those people. They were all shot through the head with the same caliber ammunition, and six police officers were also shot, which then brings the question up, well, why would the police shoot their own people? And of course they didn't. And in actual fact, that massacre in the Maidan Square was carried out by a NATO death squad. They said there was a US guy in charge of it, and they gave his name.
And not, that guy, Martin, I'm sure you remember, guy Colonel Kazimierowicz, talking about how actually it was Viktor Pinchuk, who was the Grand Master of the Freemason Lodge in the number one Freemason Lodge. He's also, of course, a massive oligarch, who was commanding the Berkut riot police on the day.
Well, I don't know.
That's
about
what
that.
He says.
Okay,
yeah.
But I mean, the point is that the oligarchy in the Ukraine,
and that he was working with the CIA.
Yeah, the oligarchy in the Ukraine has always been working closely with the West. Although Zelensky's creature, his roof originally was Kolomoisky, who's now in Israel, because Kolomoisky, in fact, was saying we're going to have to negotiate with the Russians, and of course Zelensky won the election when she won because he promised, "I'm going to end the war." Mm. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And now, of course, he's been turned into this tub-thumping Che Guevara figure. Mm. We're fighting to the end, etc., etc. But, of course, on the ground, if people are following things properly on the internet...
Well, we're going to have a bit of that in a minute.
The Russian military are carrying out a very, very serious operation.
They're on the back foot, actually, this week. Because they are. I think we're going to hear it from Scott Ritter, actually. I spoke to him yesterday about that in a minute. But I think we'll leave the discussion about Ukraine for now. Thank you very much from the Pakistan... What society is it? The Bristol Pakistan Association, Farouk Sadiq, and also Esther Giles. I don't know if it's possible to say you're from the Labour Party, is it? How would you introduce... What would you say? Say goodbye for yourself.
Oh, yeah, goodbye.
That'll do.
You're still a member?
Just about.
So am I.
And we'll suspended.
Suspended? Oh, dear. What was that for?
Order.
Are you allowed to say or not?
It's something I did in my role as CLP secretary, allowing people to debate a topic which is not allowed.
Was that something to do with, let me guess, I'm
don't
not allowed to say
any further trouble.
More trouble. Oh, God, isn't that ridiculous? I think it was something to do with the transgender issue, and I've said that, not you, so there you go. So we'll have a little bit of music, and we'll be back hearing about Ukraine from Scott Ritter, what's really been going on there.
That they're your friend.
out for the scooting. Better watch out for the scooting. One day, the track that you're climbing gets steep. Your emotions are frayed and your nerves are starting to creep. Just remember the days, as long as the time that you keep. Brother, you better watch out for the skinny. Better watch out for the skinny. Better watch out for the skinny.
That was Skin Deep with the Stranglers. Of course, this is perfect kind of music for this kind of program, because that's what we do to try and get below the skin. We seem to be, from all the time, literally day after day after day, being given superficial versions of almost every different story out there. And next week, I want to look at a couple of documentaries that are out there, which have done a very good job, I think, in drilling into the evil, really, of the financial system, the financial oligarchy in the West here, that's literally driving us all to World War III. It seems with this, just because they want to privatize everything. Of course, they tried to do that in Russia. And in 2000, a certain president was elected. I wish we'd had somebody similar here, who said, no, we're not privatizing everything. We're not selling everything off and turning this into an oligarchy and insulting the entire nation by having journalists and TV, national media, which is just telling us lies, a mixture of lies and propaganda to try and prop up the government. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those who want to bypass the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google. In fact, I've got a link up on thisweek.org.uk now to a non-Google app store, which is quite a nice little bookmark to have, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. And we get kicked straight off in part two. We'll be hearing, we hope he's waiting on the line, from Richie Allen a little bit after this, and we'll be talking to him about Ukraine and the death of the Queen, as well as some of the topics to do with COVID. After we've got the lowdown from Scott Ritter, and I thought it was quite important to get his take. He's a former US Marine Corps intelligence officer, and he was also the weapons inspector over in Iraq, about this counterattack that was launched. We didn't really know about it this time last week, but that's because it was launched on the same day that the Queen died, and which has brought some Ukrainian troops right up quite close, much closer to the Russian border, and penetrated through some of their lines of rather thin defences in the northeast of the country near Kharkov. So what did Scott make of all of this?
First of all, it's keep things in perspective. The Ukrainian army's been on the Russian border for some time now. So, to talk about the Ukrainian army, you know, going up to the Russian border in the Kharkov Oblast, yeah, it's a reversal. There's no way to spin this other than to say that Ukraine won a battle, a very important battle, a politically important battle. But it's a Pyrrhic victory for Ukraine. You know, this was predicted. Back in May, I did an interview with an American media personality named Garland Nixon. And at that time, I said the provision by the United States of $53 billion worth of military assistance, military and economic assistance, coupled with the tens of billions of dollars of similar assistance provided by NATO and European countries, coupled with intelligence that's being provided, coupled with logistics, coupled with training facilities in Europe out of the range of Russian reprisals that were training tens of thousands of Ukrainians on this new equipment. This was a game changer that it will fundamentally alter the reality of the battlefield. And what happened in September, in the early September, was a clear manifestation of this. Prior to this, one could safely say that the Ukrainian army was a military, it was a Ukrainian army that was, funded and trained and equipped by NATO and the United States, but still a Ukrainian army. The military that went into action on September 1st was a NATO army manned by Ukrainians. And there's a qualitative difference. And that qualitative difference is a direct result of the, nearly $100 billion worth of assistance that Ukraine has received from all fronts. And they took advantage of a situational failure on the part of Russia, not a systemic failure, a situational failure, combination of a operational pause after nearly 5 months of offensive operations. Russian units were resting, re-equipping, refitting. All militaries do this. You won't find a military in the world that can sustain a five-month-long offensive and just keep going. They have to pause. So the Russians hit the pause button. The Russians were also taking advantage of this pause to form their own offensive forces. And so they were stripping units away from the Kharkov region back to Russia for this purpose. And they replaced these units with units were insufficient to the task, both in terms of their organization and their doctrine. The Russian division is supposed to defend a frontage of 20 kilometers wide and up to 15 to 20 kilometers deep. And that's important, defense in depth, because Russian doctrine is designed to absorb the very kind of attack that this new NATO army manned by Ukrainians carried out to dissipate the attack, to channel it into kill zones. Then once the attack is spent, to hit it with counterattacking forces that pinch it off, surround it, and annihilate it. That's what Russian defense does. But that only works if you have Russian military units trained in this this kind of defensive operation deployed to the battlefield. These had been withdrawn to be re-equipped. They were replaced by police units, the equivalent of SWAT teams, militia units, National Guard units that were not trained, organized, equipped to fight massive frontal assaults by armor and mechanized infantry, which is what the Ukrainians
brought. In which case, Zelensky's intelligence is good. It was a masterstroke.
Well, first of all, it's not Zelensky's intelligence. It's NATO's intelligence. And it was a masterstroke. It was brilliant. It was well executed. But let's take a look at what happened. Russia, the Russian units in the front line held. The Ukrainians didn't surround and destroy any Russian units. They surrounded several Russian units that held and were holding up the attack. The Russian counterattack that was designed to blunt the Ukrainian advance was instead diverted to relieve these surrounded troops and help them withdraw in good order, preserving nearly the totality of their manpower. The most precious resource a military has is its manpower. Russia hardly lost any troops. You can count their casualties in the hundreds. Ukraine, on the other hand, took 30,000 well-trained troops and proceeded to lose more than a third of them. And they're losing them even more today in large numbers as they try to press their offensive advantage to no avail. Russia carried out a very difficult withdrawal of forces, going back to a new defensive line. They established this defensive line under pressure. The defensive line has held and is currently repulsing Ukrainian attacks. So at the end of the day, the Ukrainians got a lot of territory. It had limited strategic value for Russia. It's a huge propaganda win for the Ukrainians. Lots of selfies being taken of Ukrainians raising flags on villages and towns formerly occupied by the Russians. It's a feel-good moment. But when it's all said and done, I mean, let's imagine that we woke up not knowing anything about the counteroffensive. And I said, hey, Tony, headlines today. Ukraine loses 12,000 troops. Russia loses 200 troops. Who won that battle? And you'll say Russia. Okay, so now we suddenly pollute our minds by looking at a map where Ukraine punched into a vacuum, occupied a lot of territory, but they spent their force. They don't have any reserves left. They used them all. Russia, on the other hand, yeah, it's a defeat. Russia got beat. I mean, it's an intelligence failure. It's a failure of an imagination, but it's not a strategic failure. They preserve their manpower. They will be able to reform these units, re-equip these units, and re-employ these units. There's 12,000 Ukrainians that aren't going to be able to be used again, along with thousands of pieces of equipment.
Yeah, you've probably seen that the Russians have accused the Germans of supplying much of the equipment here. And they've actually said, I'm not quite sure who it is and where in the Russian establishment has said it, but they've said that the Germans have crossed a red line in supplying far too much of the equipment that was used in this counteroffensive.
Well, I mean, with all due respect to the Russians, boo-hoo. Grow up. What do you mean Germany provide too much equipment? You're at war with Ukraine. Ukraine's going to get the assistance it needs from Europe. And if Europe's willing to provide it, Ukraine's willing to receive it and use it. That's spilled milk. I'd like to go back to the source of that and verify, because that sounds too much like spilled milk. The Russians have always said that while they think that it's wrong for Europe to prolong this conflict by providing heavy weapons, as long as the heavy weapons aren't of a nature that can enable Ukraine to strike deep into Russia, the Russian solution will be to kill them.
Well, it may be, Scott, that a more serious criticism is they believe that there's been a massive use of mercenaries in this attack.
Well, that's real. That's very real. You know, when this conflict started, Ukraine went out and put a call out for international volunteers to form something called the International Legion. And this was an abysmal failure. People that showed up were fat couch potatoes, wannabe warriors, airsoft posers, whatever you want to say, but they weren't real. And they performed abysmally at the front line. And the Ukrainians found that having them present did more harm than good. I can't say that about the International Legion that went into battle, in this current offensive. These were extraordinarily professional forces, extremely well-trained, tactically proficient. They were brilliant in their ability to carry out deep raids behind the Russian lines to disrupt Russian logistics, command and control, etc. And you have to ask yourself, how did they make this transition? And I think the answer is that this is a different legion. These aren't so much as volunteers as these are professional warriors who exist in a database that's been assembled by the CIA and the American Department of Defense over the past 20 years through the conduct of what's called Foreign Internal Defense, which is an American special operation where Americans train the armed forces of nations designated to receive this training. And in doing so, we are able to evaluate people, assess their potential for utilization in in you know, covert actions. And I think what's happened here is that the United States, together with Germany, France, Great Britain, have tapped into this database and have done a massive recruitment of highly qualified professional warriors who they brought together using a contract employment structure. And they're very effective. They're very effective. They're very good. It's very different than what had been done before. These guys are good at reconnaissance. They're good at specialized operation, direct action, deep strike, et cetera. They're not going to change the outcome on the battlefield. The Russians already have the solution. I mean, you can only fool the Russians once. And one of the first things that happened when these units were employed is that Russia began to field counter International Legion special operations teams. That is their own convoy of light vehicles that were roaming the rear area, seeking out these International Legionnaires and close with and destroy them. So I think they had their moment. They all got to make their TikTok video. They can, you know, impress their girlfriend for the next 15 to 30 days that they'll be alive. But their time is up. Ukraine, the Russians are going to single them out and are singling them out, and they will die a violent death.
Finally, I know you're pushed for time, Scott, but we also seen the breaking out of this parallel conflict, in a way parallel, between Armenia and Azerbaijan. What do you make of that at the moment?
Well, the Armenian-Azerbaijan conflict, it dates back a long time, depending on how far we're going to go, but its recent roots are from 1988, when Nagorno-Karabakh, which is primarily an area, a mountainous area, primarily populated by Armenians, but it's located in the midst of Azerbaijani territory. They declared their independence and their desire to unite with Armenia. This led to the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, which I think came to a head in 1993, when the Armenian army was able to occupy about 15-20% of Azerbaijan, linking Nagorno-Karabakh with Armenia proper and inflicting a decisive defeat on the Azerbaijanis. They were unable to get a peace agreement, and Azerbaijan, together with Turkey, was able to build up its military capacity. And I think last year launched a major offensive that recaptured virtually all of the territory they had originally lost and inflicted a strategic defeat on the Armenian army, forcing the Armenian government to sue for peace. Since then, they've been struggling to find a ceasefire. And the reason why I bring all of this history up is this isn't a second front that was just imagined by, you know, the United States and others on how to get Russia. No, this is a unstable area of the world that has the roots of the conflict of which predate the Ukrainian conflict by years. This isn't something that just happened. This is something that has been brewing all along. It came to a head. And I think the Russians are very mature in their approach to this. They've avoided unnecessary escalation. They've refused to allow the PSTO treaty framework to be engaged directly. They're playing their relations with Turkey to tone down the Azerbaijanis. They're actually encouraging the European Union to be involved, the United Nations to be involved. So if anybody thought that this was going to be a second front that was going to drain Russian resources away from Ukraine, they're sadly mistaken.
Well, yes, you're putting a good case there, but what with this defeat in the Kharkov region and war breaking out in the Caucasus, Putin's got his big speech at the Eastern equivalent of the World Economic Forum over in Vladivostok last week with egg on his face, hasn't he?
No, he's so much more mature than that. He's looking at the big picture. The big picture is he's praising the economic ties with China, praising the economic ties with India, praising the developments that Russia's made to pivot away from the West and open up relations with the East. He's sitting in the catbird seat. No objective analyst of the bigger picture here, which recognizes that the ground war in Ukraine is but one theater of operation in a larger geopolitical struggle that hinges on economic developments. The that the end of the hegemony of the American dollar, the growth of a currency basket involving Russia, China, India, and others, where the ruble, a stable ruble, it plays critical importance. Putin has stabilized the ruble. The ruble is strengthening. The Russian economy is stable. It's strengthening. That's what Putin's focused on, because ultimately that's what's going to win this conflict. Let's wait and see what happens this winter. You know, right now, Zelensky is feeling good with a couple selfies in Izium. The Europeans are feeling good because they've provided billions of dollars worth of equipment that had an impact on the battlefield. But General Mudd is going to inject himself very soon, bogging everything down. And General Winter is going to come. And I think Russia is going to be pretty warm, well-fed, and comfortable. I can't say the same for Europe.
Okay, Scott Rizzo, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer and Iraq weapons inspector Scott Ritter speaking to me yesterday about this, a big counteroffensive that launched by Zelensky and related matters. Now, I'm also joined on the line by Richie Allen. This is getting to be a regular thing, Richie, isn't it?
Hey, thanks for inviting me back, Tony. Yeah, it is. Fascinating interview with Scott there. Really enjoyed that.
Well, I wonder what you make of what's going on in Ukraine. I mean, I keep banging on about this idea of, well, actually, it's just a kind of difference, one side and the other, between finance capitalism and mixed economies. There are some countries that still believe that voting should mean something, although I'm not sure if China could be really included in that, but that you've got to have a government that has some running and control of the infrastructure of the country. And you can't just give the financial people the whip hand and just let them decide everything. So anyway, what do you make of what you've just heard and what's going on in Ukraine?
Can I put forward a theory that's outlandish and outrageous? And I'm sure you and your listeners and Martin will jump all over it. But your listeners might remember a film directed by Barry Levinson, which came out in 1997 called Wag the Dog, starring Dustin Hoffman and Robert De Niro. Essentially, the plot was about a Hollywood producer and a political spin doctor who invented a war in Albania, a war that wasn't happening, that didn't exist, to protect the president over a sex scandal. It's an excellent bit of satire, really. I recommend that everybody who's interested in what's going on in the world today at least takes a look at it. I'm beginning to wonder if the entire Ukraine war is one massive fabrication, Tony. That's the outlandish theory. I'm not saying I believe this now, but I'm beginning to wonder, is the entire episode, the past 6 months, is it just one massive lie to distract you, me and everybody else from other things that are really going on?
Well, it doesn't have to be a lie to do the job of doing the distracting, does it?
No, it's not. No, but the reason why I think much of it might be, okay, so we saw the invasion earlier this year, 6 months ago. We could talk about that and what happened in the weeks and the early months thereafter. But I would argue that for the last 2 to 3 months, very little has been going on in Ukraine. Very little at all. That it's basically been reduced to a bit of a quagmire or a stalemate, the odd skirmish notwithstanding. And what I've been thinking a lot about recently is conversations I've had with people going back to the beginning of the first lockdown in March 2020, people who had traditionally been on the side of the Russians and Vladimir Putin and his predecessors when it came to NATO encroachment on Russia and US military bases amassing on the Russian border, despite promises made after the fall of the Berlin Wall that this wouldn't happen. And I was, would have been somebody who would have backed the Russian interest or the Russian righteousness, I suppose, the right of the Russians to defend themselves and their territory. But I've also been doing a lot of looking into Vladimir Putin and who he is. And it just struck me today that it was only last October, which is not even a year ago, that Russia joined the World Economic Forum Center for the Fourth Industrial Revolution Network. And we talked about that at the time and we thought it was pretty big news, but then it kind of went away. And that's not insignificant. And Putin's own relationship with Klaus Schwab and his own relationship with the World Economic Forum going back many years.
It's broken down. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that relationship's broken down now.
since October, you think it's broken?
Yeah, because I mean, for example, today we've got something called the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement Summit going on, and Putin and Xi have basically said that we need to change the entire international system. They've brought Iran into full membership of the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement. So what they're doing is they are setting up something which is countering and opposed to the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and I think that's happened really since. I think they tried everything they could last year, so far as I can see, Richie, to try and get the US to sign some sort of, and NATO to sign a security agreement in Europe. And then when that just failed, we had Zelensky calling for nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Yeah. The relationship is now broken down between the people like the World Economic Forum and the Russians. Martin, anyway, can I just bring you in on this announcement of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization? Because it's quite an important organization, this, isn't it? They're now saying... today, you know, they're Putin and Xi together are saying, basically, we need a new version of the United Nations because it's not fit for purpose.
Yeah, I think that's that. There is clearly, to my mind, you know, two blocks developing here. But on the other hand, of course, there are going to be similarities between the two blocks. I mean, the sort of thing we used to say in the 1980s, you know, neither Washington nor London nor Moscow. And, you know, we thought that what would needed to happen, and I was very involved with the Polish Solidarity Campaign in the 1980s, for example, was that we needed to break down the bloc mentality, that the real enemies were always at home, that for us, our own ruling class, and in Russia and Poland, for their own ruling class. And that was, you know, quite an important part of my own political development and formation. But I think what's happening now is that, you know, Xi and Putin are saying that we are the people who are more prepared to create a stable environment for investment than these lunatics who don't know what they're doing. So they're trying to take over. You know, there isn't, they don't, they want a stable world order, which involves doing deals with the West. And that includes the World Economic Forum. I mean, both Xi and Putin have turned up to that. That doesn't mean they're on the same side as the World Economic Forum. They turned up to the Munich Security Conference where Putin started reading the Riot Act in 2007. I think both of them, or both countries, want a stable, productive relationship with the West, and they certainly haven't just closed the door. Although I noticed today that the Chinese delegation is not going to be allowed to go and look at the lying in state of the Queen Elizabeth because they're such evil people that they can't be allowed to go anywhere near.
Every bit as evil as the Russians. But look, there's another aspect to what's going on. I mean, quite clearly, just hang on, Richie, because I think, you know, what you've done is you put a very contentious idea there, is that these people are not dying in the sort of rates that we're being told they are. The Russians are saying that they are dying, and they're saying that they're getting increasingly annoyed. They're saying, in fact, it's Maria Zakharova that's talking about this red line being crossed by the injection of these, the German, I think they're called the Mars long-range missiles, and in the United States they're called the HIMARS. Now, these are being used for long range, and in fact they're called it's called a rocket system, but they're not, they're guided weapons. They are basically it's a missile system, and these are able to hit into Russia, and these are now being Lockheed Martin in the States, and the German manufacturers are now ramping up their production, pouring these things into Ukraine to allow the Ukrainian army to press the buttons, obviously with the guidance and the technology to target them, supplied by satellites from NATO into Russia itself. And the Russians are saying, you're now crossing a red line here, Germany and the United States. That's what Zakharova is saying. So it does certainly seem as if they're also reiterating this warning that if you threaten the existence of Russia, we will nuke you.
I want to come back. Look, this is relevant. I want to come back to this.
But that's not just a show, Richie, is it? It's not just a show.
I don't know, Tony. I leave room for every eventuality and every possibility. Back on the 13th of October last year, the Kremlin announced that Russia will take a leading role, that's a direct quote, in shaping the trajectory of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. That's very significant. And I haven't seen much changing outside of the invasion of Ukraine since then. And you make a good point about Iran and China. But ultimately, the forces behind the World Economic Forum and the Fourth Industrial Revolution, ultimately China is where they want to take everybody. you know, a cashless society, a social credit framework of
governance. I think you're right in that there certainly seems to be more people in the West than in Russia that want to do that. But Martin, can I just ask you to I mean, what does it mean bringing these high accuracy missiles in from the US and Germany? The Russians are saying, look, don't threaten existence of Russia. Don't start attacking Russia itself. Otherwise, we may nuke you.
Well, I mean, that is the sort of, that's a gentle boiling of the rhetoric, and we could easily end up with a nuclear exchange here, which will make the fourth industrial revolution rather irrelevant. What's it Einstein said? The next world war is going to be fought with sticks and stones.
Sticks and stones, yeah.
I think the Chinese everybody is going to have to go down this road with social credit and controlling population, because that's what you do in wartime. That's what happened in World War One. That's what happened in World War Two. There was rationing. The secret police could knock on your door and say, we think you're a German spy. And Liz Truss is going on about she wants a liberated Britain full of the free market, except that she's going to, you know, it's all going to be paid for by the taxpayer. And, of course, she also wants a war with Russia. And Ben Wallace, who's the defence secretary, said he used to be in the Scots Guards, saying, well, the Scots Guards kicked the Russians' backside in the Crimean War, and I'm sure we could do it again. This guy is in charge. Now, these people are delusional.
But they're not in charge, Martin.
Well, no. I mean, they are not in charge. Of course they're not. No. But they're delusional. You know, it just shows what level they're on when they come out with remarks like that. I think that the danger is that we are going to go towards a kind of 1984 style setup where there are two big blocks. And they have to use exactly the same methods to control their population, mobilise them and so on. You've got to make people accept that they're going to have rationing and all the rest of it. And that is where we're going, because that's what war does. It's no longer about the free market. It's about something else.
Now, what about this massacre at Izium, apparently, that's been discovered by the advancing Ukrainian army? 440 bodies in a mass grave. Zelensky is comparing it with the Bucha massacre, Martin.
Well, the Bucha massacre, all the evidence shows that was probably carried out by the Ukrainians. And there's overwhelming evidence that the Ukrainians just make stuff up. The ghost of Kiev, this supposed fantastic air ace that shot down loads of Russian planes, even teenagers could work out this is actually from a video game. But that was pushed by the Ukrainian government, and they even said afterwards, yes, it was us pushing that, but we needed to boost morale. And then the next time they turn around and say, oh, yes, and another thing, we've got something very truthful to tell you about what we found in Izium. I mean, they just make stuff up, so you can't take it serious.
Also, Richie, officials in the Russian-occupied areas have been reported dead. Hundreds of bodies have said to have been found in the retaken Ukraine city. So this is apparently about another massacre carried out by the Russians at Izium, according to Zelensky.
Yeah. Who knows, Tony? We touched on this last week, and you and I have touched on it before. Who knows? What I've become more willing to consider as a possibility is something that I would have been hypercritical of other people for talking about in the past, and that is there is a desired future. There is a future. There is an elite that has a future planned for us, for humanity, to take us into a very horrible way of living, more controlled maybe than most people could ever imagine. And I'm willing to consider the possibility that everybody, either consciously or unconsciously, is involved in that, including people that we would have, you know, previously, or I would have previously thought to be diametrically opposed ideologically and morally, whether it be China, whether it be Russia, whether it be Iran. I'm beginning to believe, and I don't have the evidence for this, it's just a theory, that the same entities, and I don't mean supernatural now, in case anyone thinks I do, that are controlling the think tanks and the politicians in our countries, are also directly controlling those in Russia, China, and Iran.
Events will prove us whether that's the case or not. It certainly seems to me as if the Russians are definitely pushing back. Anyway, let's look now at the death of the Queen. I was going through some of my archives. I don't know if you saw the pictures of Prince Charles, etc., and doing his speeches. I don't know if you've been following all that stuff Richie. But I thought I thought the most important thing to really to do is to give King Charles III a bit of airtime. His first address, which he was making roughly the same time as we were on air last week, this time last week, as his first address as sovereign on Friday the 9th of September.
That's right. In her life of service, we saw that abiding love of tradition, together with that fearless embrace of progress, which makes us great as nations. The affection, admiration, and respect she inspired became the hallmark of her reign. And as every member of my family can testify, she combined these qualities with warmth, humor, and an unerring ability always to see the best in people. I pay tribute to my mother's memory, and I honor her life of service. I know that her death brings great sadness to so many of you, and I share that sense of loss beyond measure with you all. When the Queen came to the throne, Britain and the world were still coping with the privations and aftermath of the Second World War, and still living by the conventions of earlier times. In the course of the last 70 years, we have seen our society become one of many cultures and many faiths. The institutions of the state have changed in turn. But through all changes and challenges, our nation and the wider family of realms, of whose talents, traditions, and achievements I am so inexpressibly proud, have prospered and flourished. Our values have remained and must remain constant.
So, Richie, what do you make of him as a speaker? Quite different to the Queen, isn't he? He has a different kind of intonation. I think, you know, from Queen's speeches and other speeches that she's made. In fact, we could even hear one of those in a minute. He's got a different persona, different manner to him.
He sounds very much like him. This is obviously I've never met the guy and never would meet the guy. He sounds very much to me like somebody who's in love with the sound of his own voice. Very fond of himself and what he is saying. I've read several times over the years, maybe more so in the 90s when his popularity was pretty much on the floor, that it's been said by many people who met him that he's not very bright, or at least not as bright as he would have you believe he is. I would, you know, think of him pretty much of a bore, really. I couldn't imagine anything worse than sitting through an after-dinner speech given by someone like him, Tony. I don't know what to read into any of that. I'm very fascinated by this notion that, you know, so very, very many people are sad. I don't buy into the idea that such a large percentage of the population is sad and is grieving for the Queen. And I have my reasons for saying that. I'm very interested in the phenomenon of grief porn and mourning sickness. I'm hugely interested. I've read a lot about that over the years, you know, turning people into participants in the news as opposed to observers and stuff like
that. Okay, well, look,
I don't know, that's another day,
coming back at you. I'd just like to play a clip from Al Jazeera, because I was looking around at the weekend for anyone doing a really good job at looking at what's been going on in London. I mean, it was quite overwhelming to see, rather like when Diana died, to see the mountains of flowers being brought by people from all over London. And I mean, you know, you can't just dismiss that as, oh, well, you know, they're just doing what they've seen on
when we come back.
On the TV.
Give me a chance to explain when we come back.
Of course, of course, yeah.
30 seconds, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So here is Al Jazeera looking at the, over the weekend, looking at the flowers, in all the flowers that have been brought in as tributes to the Queen. Let's have a listen to that now. And there's also a little bit of a comment in here, which we haven't seen over here, about just how easy this transition from Queen Elizabeth II to King Charles III is going to be.
Seemingly without end, the floral tributes have spilled out from Buckingham Palace onto the gardens of Green Park. The crowds, unrelenting, snake their way along a one-way system that no one quite understands, so they just follow the people in front. Volunteers are pressed into action, fetching, carrying, removing plastic packaging. Loving messages remember a queen who was the nation's grandmother.
Anyone like to grab some flowers?
We've been here since about 6 this morning, just trying to clear the flowers from over near the palace. What we've found since we've been here is we've been completely overwhelmed. We've done 15 trucks so far, and everyone's just coming in, giving us a hand. We just look at the people, they're picking everything up. They're litter picking, they're clearing everything up. It's absolutely fantastic. In the 20 or so years that I've been in horticulture, I've never seen anything like it.
It's almost like a kind of pilgrimage, isn't it? Thousands of people coming here, many with a genuine sense of grief, others to have a physical experience of history and to leave their mark. And a majority generally approve of the monarchy in Britain today, but much of that is down to the popularity of the Queen and her grandchildren. For younger generations, it is an institution with questionable relevance.
Personally, it doesn't affect me. I know that might sound a bit insensitive, but I understand the significance, but it doesn't have an impact on my life personally. I think that's the general feeling with my friends.
I think they're a good... It's good to have, like, a head of the country, have, like, a figure to look up to, but I just don't think that is relatable for a lot of people now.
God save the king.
God save the king.
While the new king is proclaimed in places great and small across the country, many simply go about their business. King Charles has work to do to fill his mother's place in the nation's affection. Jonah Hull, Al Jazeera, London.
Yes, and that's the sort of comment that you're not seeing on the press in this part of the country. So before you go, Richie, I think I have to actually play you an extract from this band interview where Diana says, it's only a short clip, how she thinks Charles will do if he ever becomes king.
But you would know him better than most people. Do you think he would wish to be king?
There was always conflict on that subject with him when we discussed it. And I understood that conflict, because it's a very demanding role, being Prince of Wales, but it's equally a more demanding role, being king. And being Prince of Wales produces more freedom now, and being king would be a little bit more suffocating. And because I know the character, I would think that the top job, as I call it, would bring enormous limitations to him. And I don't know whether he could adapt to that.
Do you think it would make more sense, in the light of the marital difficulties that you and the Prince of Wales have had, if the position of monarch passed directly to your son, Prince William?
Well, then you have to see that William's very young at the moment, so do you want a burden like that to be put on his shoulders at such an age? So I can't answer that question.
Would it be your wish that when Prince William comes of age, that he were to succeed the Queen rather than the current Prince of Wales?
My wish is that my husband finds peace of mind, and from that follows other things, yes.
So, Richie, she's making it pretty clear there. She thinks that the role would be too suffocating for Charles. He likes to fly free like a bird. You can't do that when you're king.
Yeah, I suppose she's referring maybe subtly to some of the trauma that we imagine the guy might have gone through in his schooling days and later on in his relationship with Louis Mountbatten. The caveat on that is we just don't know. But I would ask you, I know you're going to kick me off now, and I'm brilliant to be back on. I love this show. I really do. Look into the phenomenon of morning sickness, which began, a lot of people believe, began around about 1996 after the Dunblane massacre, carried on when Diana died. This phenomenon of a mass public response, grieving and weeping and wailing, not just in the country where the event took place, but around the world. Look into that from the point of view. A lot of psychologists, psychiatrists and journalists have looked into this, and the part the media plays in that in, you know, focusing so much on the public reaction to these events, which is what happened. Sky have done it. The BBC has done it for 5-6 days in a row. Endless pulling people out of queues and asking them for their reaction to this stuff. I think there's a lot more to that than meets the eye. And I'm not convinced that so many people are genuinely upset or sad at the demise of this monarch whom they never knew, who never even gave an interview in the 70 years she was on the throne.
But I think they are. I think they are, personally. I mean, I don't know if they would be for Camilla and Charles, though. And I noticed there was a clip CBS put out the night before last, which was just a fascinating little insight. I think Charles, it seemed, had forgotten that there was a camera on him while he was signing the Book of Condolence. I'm not sure where it was. But it was very interesting to see just how grumpy he was about... You know, and obviously he's had a lot to do over the last few days, but swearing about something as simple as, you know, his pen was leaking, you know. Yeah. So I don't know how, you know, whether you think that his international role might eclipse this role as king here, because he does seem to be much happier sitting down with people at these massive international summits, doesn't he?
You might be right, Tony, and this is the thing that's got a lot of... I've heard a lot of discussion of this on, to be fair to the BBC, for all the bashing we give it. Quite a number of programmes. The Today programme has dealt with this. Breakfast has dealt with this. Will the guy do what his mother seemingly did, and that is keep your nose out of the events of the day, the geopolitical events of the day, or will he poke his oar in, particularly when it comes to the climate, to the environment? That remains to be seen. I based on what I've read and seen and heard from this guy in my time as a journalist, I don't think he'll be able to help himself. And I think you touched on something interesting there. Wouldn't be surprised as they ramp up the climate fear porn if this guy starts showing up at some of these Extinction Rebellion things. I don't mean we should expect to see him gluing himself to the pavement. I don't. But if there are international gatherings of several of these groups as the hysteria gets louder and louder, I wouldn't be surprised if... this guy directly addresses some of these people and some of these things, Tony. That's going to be hugely interesting.
Okay, well, finally, before you go, what about this whole business of not getting any kind of explanation of a cause of death? Because we're going to hear an interview now, or a clip from Dr. David Halpin talking about what he thinks may have caused, and also, along with me, being rather dismayed that someone, that even of 96 years old, that dies so suddenly, that the establishment doesn't feel like it's got to give any explanation whatsoever.
I think you're onto something. By the way, what a lovely gentleman Dr. David Halpin is. Hello to him if he's listening in. He probably is. Lovely gentleman, very learned. Absolutely, Tony. Absolutely, the public, the media, the public is entitled to have this information pretty rapidly, at least a day or so after the event. Look, I know you're very suspicious about it. The timing of it, so soon after the appointment of Liz Truss, or the election victory of Liz Truss and her ascension to the position of Prime Minister. Absolutely, it bears investigating, but I don't hold out any hope for you and others that anything is going to be done about it, Tony.
Well, we shall see. And also, I'd like to give you a bit of a pat on the back, because last week you pointed out that it was either George the...
I got it wrong.
George the Fifth or George the Sixth? No, you didn't. You said you weren't sure which one it was. Well, anyway, you're quite right. George the Fifth was euthanized. This is absolutely true. And it's because the diary of the doctor who was treating him at the time was publicised. It was actually on the front page of the Daily Telegraph in November 1986, and that he had indeed been euthanized. In fact, looking at the documentary which has been done about that, I'm just looking now for the, I think it's Mark John Maguire did the documentary last year actually about that. What he said is that Edward the Eighth had got wind that George the Fifth, who was, you know, he wasn't amazingly good health, but he wasn't about to die, was considering taking measures to pass him over and hand the monarchy on to his younger brother George the Sixth, and that while he was actually up at Sandringham, he got the doctor, King George the Fifth's doctor, Dr. Bertram Dawson, to inject George the Fifth with doses of morphine and cocaine to tip him over the edge.
Yeah, that's right. That's bang on, T. I'd read that somewhere months ago, and then I read it again, I think the day after the Queen had died. There was an article somewhere about, you know, about how recent monarchs, but how previous monarchs had met their end, had met their demise. So absolutely fascinating.
So it's another reason why we need an explanation, isn't it?
ASAP.
Anyway. All right, anyway, Richie, do you want to just plug your website and tell us when you're going to be back, please, the latest?
Before the end of the month, it's richieallen.co.uk. I love this programme. We need more programmes like the Not the BCFM Politics Show, and I say that with the utmost sincerity. I can count on one hand around the world where presenters and producers invite people on who see the world differently than they do. It's the way it used to be. It's brilliant, mate. Congratulations. Keep it up.
Well, that's called it's professional journalism, actually, is let's have different points of view. If everyone's got the same point of view, it gets a little bit dull, doesn't it?
Boring.
Anyway, someone else like us with different point of view on many of these things is Dr. David Halpin, and so here is he talking about what he made from a pathological point of view, like what happened when the Queen died last Thursday.
In a death of someone who'd been fit, like she was, with an intact mind, that you would have expected to hear some, inverted commas, narrative as to how she was becoming ill over those 2 days. I agree with you. But that reflects this, and it's a very, very important subject. We were taught that the last duty to our patient was to attend a post-mortem of that patient, if that was indicated. And in the hospitals, I often asked for a post-mortem, but it became more and more difficult to get them, partly because of costs, no doubt, and the cost wasn't great anyway. We had pathologists on tap who would do a post-mortem, and I used to take the teams as I led. There were very few deaths in the orthopedic hospital, very, very few indeed, but quite a few because of elderly people with fractures in Torbay Hospital. I used to take them down for mortuary because the fact is this, Tony. These are very, very important facts. About, it said something like 40% of the pre-mortem diagnoses that doctors make are found to be erroneous, wrong. And you only learn to sharpen your diagnostic skills partly from attending post-mortems and finding out what the patient actually died from. I could give you many instances where a surprise came up in one case where I actually showed the pathologist something which he'd missed when I was a young casualty officer at Paddington General Hospital in Paddington. But the thing is this, do you know what the rate of post-mortem is? When I last looked it up, I can't say that this figure was true, but it was on the internet. It was said that only 2% of hospital deaths came to autopsy, post-mortem. That's disgusting. Disgusting. Because you reflect then on the erroneous diagnoses. One thing has happened. CAT scans have made diagnosis in life and in death, actually, more accurate without autopsy. And in fact, they've been trying to substitute CAT scans for autopsy. But it is not a complete substitute, partly because you have no tissue samples, and analyzing the tissues and examining under the microscope add more things. I asked Torbay Hospital via a good colleague there if they were doing postmortems on people dying of COVID, because they would have shown with electron microscope virions, as they're properly called, under the microscope in the tissues like the kidney and the liver and the lung. I never got a reply. I don't think postmortems are being done. They probably made the excuse of the corpse being infected or something like that. But we've been dealt with. Science has been destroyed. Medicine, apart from being an art, it depends on good science. And I was good on pathology, and I continued always to respect the study of the abnormal processes in the human body. And if you do it well, and it's always in your mind, it gives you X-ray eyes when you're presented with a sick patient.
I mean, they may well say, David, that, oh, well, actually, we had to embalm the Queen, and there was no chance to do that.
Well, I suppose they did. But you see, wouldn't that be... See, people need to... They talk about now about people should be talking more easily about death and their own deaths. as they faced death. But, you know, really, we should have known that, really, whether she was embalmed or not. I don't think I would expect an autopsy of the Queen unless something was dramatically wrong. There are question marks. I agree with you about the precipitate or the rather fast process to death in the sovereign. Yeah. I realize that it would have been better if there was an obviously truthful account of her last 48 hours.
So that was Dr. David Halpin. Amazingly, actually doing a bit of speculation on what may have killed the Queen, something that can kill an elderly person that quickly. But, Martin, we shouldn't really be having to speculate. It would be surely simple for the Balmoral, the royals, to tell us, well, she died of a stroke or something.
Well, that's the way to stop speculation, isn't it? If you just come front up and say, well, she died of a heart attack, for example, then we know what it was. And but they're not saying that, are they?
No. And I thought I'd play a clip from Mark John Maguire, as I was talking to Richie Allen about that, about the murder of King George V. Without hearing this first, do you think it's feasible that King George V, the Telegraph headline said he was euthanized? Is this normal?
Well, I mean, Dylan Thomas, people thought that he died of alcoholic poisoning, but in actual fact, he was given morphine. He was off his head through drinking when he was in New York, but he was given morphine by the doctors, and it killed him. And in actual fact, in that era, people used to prescribe morphine, you know, for all sorts of things, and rather inappropriately.
After George V's death, Lord Dawson continued as physician to Edward VIII. For his short, uncrowned reign, the man whom he had made king, and curiously enough, within weeks, he was elevated to the highest rank of the peerage available to him, as Viscount Dawson of Penn. A suitable reward, perhaps. Of course, people whispered. Other royal doctors exchanged the knowing looks, and it was probably they who invented the popular and telling rhyme, Dawson of Penn killed many men. That's why we sing, God Save the King. After Dawson died in 1945, the entry in his diary was discovered by his biographer, Francis Watson, who decided against including it in his 1950 biography out of respect for Dawson's widow. It was not until its publication in 1986 that its full import became known, and then its reception was curiously muted. Discussion inevitably centered on the rights and wrongs of euthanasia, rather than the first principle of inquiry, as to what precisely had happened and why. It was left to foreign newspapers to report the truth. There it was reported that King George V was murdered. No one in Britain would dare say it. The death of King George V in 1936 was met with a great outpouring of national grief. Perhaps such mourning was for the passing of an old order of monarchy, an intuitive realization that things were changing, and that even the panoply of monarchy could not last forever. The notion of constitutional monarchy provides only an interim model for a government in transition, a government on a journey which must inevitably lead to another concept of government, be that one of representative democracy in function, or one more appropriate to the modern age. The idea of hereditary monarchy is a medieval one, itself a natural development from that of old tribal chieftains squabbling for land. If we are wistful for its loss, then it is a wistfulness for old traditions, for simpler times, a nostalgia for the good old days, even though we know in our hearts they were no such thing. George V did have his way in one respect. His dearest wish was that the crown should pass to his second son, Bertie, and thereafter to his granddaughter, Elizabeth. Lilibet. It did. She is still queen today, 95 years and counting. George V's funeral took place on the 28th of January. At 12:15 a.m. his four sons undertook the vigil of the princes in the great medieval hall of Westminster. The princes royal stood guard in full military uniform at their father's catafalque as they awaited dawn. In the morning the coffin was mounted onto a gun carriage, And as the cortege moved out of the great hall, the imperial crown fell and rolled in the gutter in New Palace Yard. Perhaps it was an ill omen. A long horse guards parade the cortege passed, bound for Hyde Park, and thence by royal train to Windsor. The five regiments of guards stood sentinel upon its way. At Windsor, the Lord Chamberlain broke his staff of office and laid it upon the coffin as it was lowered. His office was done.
So that's Mark John Maguire there. His video, which is around about an hour long, from 2021, examining the death of King George V in 1936 and the role of Dr. Bertrand Dawson, later Lord Dawson, in euthanising him, Martin.
Well, it's interesting, and it's all information, and it's relevant to what's happening. But since we were talking earlier about getting obsessed with the monarchy and all these people getting, we seem to have gone into very deep waters in exactly the way suggested.
What do you mean? Was it morning sickness?
Yes.
Well, look, I mean, this is a news story, and this is, yes. I think, fascinating. Did you know that George
I mean, it's all information, Tony.
Did you know that George V was euthanised?
No, I didn't.
No, well, it's quite clear. And I'm quite happy to put on our show page at thisweek.org.uk the front page from the Daily Telegraph, this November 1986 edition, which says exactly that. Now, I mean, he goes further, he says it was murder rather than just euthanasia, because the king didn't actually want to die at all. He was starting to maneuver his affairs so that he could pass over Edward VIII, who turned out, by the way, to be a disastrous king.
Well, it may be that Edward VIII, I mean, you've got, if there's murder involved, you've got to have means, motive and opportunity.
Sandringham, he was there.
Okay, so what's the motive? And of course, it would be Edward VIII who had the motive. Okay. But I don't, you know, this is for police officers to investigate at the time.
Oh, come on, the police officer's not going to investigate this, are they?
No, well, all right, well, I'm interested to a point in this, but there's also, you know...
The other thing is he says there is this is an ancient, outdated, silly system we've got with the monarchy.
Well, I mean, that is an obvious point to make, isn't it? I mean, why do you need one? Why do you need a monarchy? Good question, isn't it?
Is it better in France, where they've got a French president?
Well, it's just different. And, of course, in Barbados, recently, they voted to get rid of the monarchy as head of state. And in Jamaica, that's definitely being talked about. And once developing countries in the Commonwealth start to decide, actually, we don't want the Queen as head of state, and they start copying each other, then that will be a change, won't it?
So I did ask Richie about this. I mean, what do you think about the character of Charles taking over? Do you think it will make any difference?
Well, I think he's clearly, the Queen is respected as a human being in a way that he is not, which is why he's going to find it a very hard row to hoe, isn't he? A hard act to follow. Never work with children or animals. Or Queen Elizabeth II, because they won't definitely upstage you, won't they?
And we're not the only people who are raising questions. This time last week, up on BBC Radio Scotland, the boss of the Church of Scotland, who was with the Queen over the weekend before, expressed his surprise that she died so quickly.
Let's speak now to the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, the Right Reverend Dr. Ian Greenshields. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Lots of people have been sharing their memories of the Queen with us this morning. I understand you were with her very recently, just at the weekend. Is that right?
Yes, I spent the weekend at Balmoral and had dinner with the Queen on Saturday and lunch with her on Sunday. Yeah.
And how was she? How did she seem?
She was in great form, really good spirit. Obviously frail, you could see that, but absolutely on the ball.
Was sparky, conversational, just kind of alert?
Very, very much so. Talking about her past, her love for Balmoral, her father, her mother, Prince Philip, horses. You know, very much engaged with, you know, what was happening in the church and what was happening in the nation too.
Yeah.
As far as her faith was concerned, it was very obvious. Particularly, I would say, in the last 10 years in her Christmas Day addresses, how personal and how deep that went. Talking to her, she had an incredible memory. She knows and she knew and understood exactly, you know, what the challenges were that faced the church. She talked about that very clearly when she was speaking with me over the weekend. It was obvious that she knew what she was talking about, and it was really quite interesting to be able to sit down with somebody who was appraised of everything. It's not just that, you know, she knew that from her own resources. She obviously had, I suppose, reflected on it, thought about the situation that we were in, wanted to know how we as a church were facing up to it and what we were going to be doing with respect to, I suppose, outreaching into Scotland.
You were saying that she was still in very good form at the weekend. Can I ask then, when this sudden news came yesterday, it must have taken you by surprise?
Very much so, yes. I mean, obviously, his health was frail. We knew that. But when I left her on Sunday, she was very positive. And I just find it very hard to believe that in those few days, things had changed so much.
So that's the Reverend Dr. Ian Greenshields. He's not the only one who finds it hard to believe. I think we deserve, basically, as a nation, some sort of an explanation as to why the Queen died so quickly or what she died of. Something very simple. It's not, I think, any more of an imposition than anyone would expect from for the nation's grandmother. And also, one of the other things, Martin, with all of this is it was I'm going to put a photograph of it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I found it quite shocking that we had a peculiar salute by, well, I was shocked to see it, by one of the police up at Balmoral, where he actually, King Charles's car with Camilla is coming past, he puts his hand up over his eye like this. And then he does a salute. Have you ever seen a policeman do a salute with his hand over his right eye and then back down to the ground? I've never seen those before.
No, I haven't, Tony.
Anyway, looking online, it's a Masonic sign, apparently. And so I thought we'd have a little listen to something about the Masonic mafia and the business of crime, because it looked to me as if there was some sort of Masonic influence here. This is actually an extract of a piece put together by Vice magazine, but they're obviously their online thing, which is looking at the link between the Masons and the mafia.
In Italy, the bond between Freemasonry and mafia groups in the south has a long, complicated history. There are superficially shared values. Both were heavily repressed between the 1920s until the end of World War II as potential threats to the power of Mussolini's fascist state. And both have a long, contentious relationship with the pillars of Italian political and commercial society, one where rumours of collusion and corruption are never too far from the surface.
The fact that the 'Ndrangheta is well connected and deeply rooted in this society, with connection to politicians, businessmen, police officers, magistrates, judges, and that's its the strain of the mafia.
In a wiretapped conversation in 2013, one 'Ndrangheta boss, Pantaleone Mancuso, summed up the relationship. The 'Ndrangheta is no longer, he said. The Freemasons remain. In 2017, a series of police raids discovered 193 high-ranking members of the Sicilian Mafia and the Calabrian 'Ndrangheta to be members of lodges across the south. According to the work of dogged prosecutors and the testimony of mob turncoats, the secrecy of Masonic lodges provided the perfect place to conduct shady deals with figures from the business and political elite. Later, a series of local lodges in Calabria were dissolved after discovery of mobsters on their books. One case which has become infamous is that of Giovanni Zumbo. A well-respected Calabrian accountant, he had made a name for himself, managing properties seized from organized crime on behalf of the courts. But Zumbo was later convicted of mafia crimes after law enforcement discovered that he had been tipping off one notorious local boss about a looming arrest.
We have this guy, an accountant, that goes to Pelle, one of the biggest godfather of 'Ndrangheta, while he was on the run. He goes there and tells to the man, there are the recordings of this, telling, be careful, they are going to arrest you, they are going to make a big operation a week before, and giving also the exact numbers of people that they are going to be arrested. When it's going to arrest it himself.
How could an accountant get inside information about a sensitive police operation? Turns out one of his fellow masons was a senior police officer on the same force. This is, critics allege, how the relationship works. Lodges are a connecting bridge between organised crime and the state.
Well, let's hope not. Up at Balmoral, you know, politicians, judges, magistrates, police, military, all in the same lodge. Potentially, you've got a nest of vipers here, a criminal network. And this might explain why we have so many problems with our criminal justice system.
The criminal justice system in Italy is well known to be totally corrupted by the Mafia, who were put in power at the end of the Second World War by the NATO intelligence services. The whole Gladio operation and all the rest of it. And of course, who were the masters of Gladio? MI6 and the CIA. So all of these things, it's common knowledge. The dogs in the street know this.
And, well, they don't, actually. But anyway, what about the Pinay Circle? Also involved in the Gladio.
Yes, I know, but
previous and our present chancellor.
I am quite sure the Russian FSB have got on the walls of their offices all of these people and the links and linkages between.
They throw darts at them, do they?
Yes, just like you see in the police procedurals on the TV, and it's easy to, you know, it's all, the devil is always in the detail with all of this stuff, isn't it? Who actually knows who?
Well, it's interesting. What
relationship do they actually have?
I will post up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk the, I think, astonishing photograph of the Masonic police salute, where the policeman is covering his right eye as Charles and Camilla go into the Balmoral estate for your delectation, ladies and gentlemen. So we'll finish, as we get towards the end, we're going to go something a little bit lighter, which is to do with planning. And this was at last week's Prime Minister's Questions, Greenbelt planning.
Father of the House, Sir Peter Bottomley. Yeah.
All sides of the House should wish to help the Prime Minister be successful in tackling the problems facing the country.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When I raised one of them with the former Prime Minister in July, he said I could talk to the Housing Minister, but the Housing Minister retired after 17 minutes of hearing that. Can I ask the Prime Minister to look to see why the Planning Inspectorate are able to overturn Council's planned protections for green lungs, and will she look at what's happening to the Goring Gap, the A259, in Worthing West and in South Downs constituency, because local councils have no role if they can't protect what matters most to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I am a bit concerned about offering the Honourable Gentleman a meeting with the Housing Minister in case any ill should befall him. But look, my Honourable friend is right. There is not enough power in local hands at the moment. It is too easy for local councils to be overruled by the Planning Inspectorate, and that is certainly an issue that I'm expecting my Secretary of State for Housing to look at.
That's a discussion about the North Downs and planning there. I spoke earlier this week to an individual called Jake, who's part of something called Landscapes for Freedom down in Brighton, and they're actually organising. They're so annoyed about the Centre Parks building all over a beautiful area of outstanding natural beauty. And, of course, that's why people like Peter Bottomley are asking these questions. It's because we're in a situation now with great deal. Martin, you know, also, of course, Mason's involved in planning decisions, getting how we can get planning permission on planning committees, this sort of thing. Because it's basically, if you get planning permission for one of these big developments, like whether it be a big office block or a centre park, it's just like printing money.
It is, but I find it rather odd that you're obsessed with the idea that the Masons must be behind everything.
I didn't say that.
No,
well, they certainly are.
Planning decisions.
The reason I bring it in is because there is some pretty It's very, very solid evidence that with the speculators and developers, if they've got some people who are also in the same Masonic Lodge in the planning committee, that this has been going on. We did a documentary when I was at the BBC in Southampton on this.
It's well known, Tony, that the Freemasonry has been used in exactly the way you've described. But, of course, there are all sorts of other decisions being made behind closed doors by secretive elites that have nothing to do with the Masons at all.
Well, many of these decisions, they have nothing to do with Freemasonry, of course. But what I'm saying is it's a connection to the last story in that you've got this mass trespass that Jake is organising for next weekend, that's next Saturday, the 24th of September, is all to do with an incredibly, an unbelievable decision, really, to take an area of outstanding natural beauty, which is supposed to have the sort of protection that a national park has, in order to build a massive centre parks all over it.
Well, we all know who rules the roost in this country. And local authorities, people complain about the planning decisions that have been made here in Bristol. If they tried to buck the central planning people, they would lose. Because developers are allowed to appeal against what local councils decide, but local councils aren't allowed to appeal against developers. And therefore, there's a pressure on local councils just to agree with what developers want to do. Because in actual fact, it's a pointless opposing it, because it'll be overruled anyway.
Well, one thing that is certainly not pointless is having a mass trespass over the land that you may be about to lose. And that's what Jake has been doing when he spoke to me earlier this week.
And we have to do it for a whole range of very practical reasons. As I said, the first and most important overwhelming reason is that you can't fight for something you don't know. But if you pick that apart, if you're not actually in there recording the wildlife and actually measuring and checking and recording and listing the wildlife which is present there, you can't build a case. You can't build the strongest case against its destruction. If the only people who are allowed there are the developers people and the landowners people, the evidence will never be created, which will never be put in the public realm, which would enable us to properly, robustly defend this resource. You simply cannot protect a place that you can't know, you're not able to know. How would that be possible? I mean, you could resort to its defending it on the basis of its formal designations. The majority of it is registered ancient woodland. It's all in the high weald, what's called AONB, Area of Outstanding Natural Beauty, which is a planning designation which is meant to have the same force in law as a national park. So formally speaking, on grounds of law, no proposal should ever have been made for this site. It's plain as the nose on my face that no proposal should be made. It's registered ancient woodland, and there's a whole disposition that no development should be allowed in ancient woodland except for the most the most exceptional reasons. And it's in an AONB, which is meant to be protected like a national park. But this, I know that this won't cut the mustard. Centre Park are a huge international, highly capitalised business with friends in very high places. I think a couple of their directors were in the government ministers in the last Tory administration, Boris's administration. We can't rely simply on appealing to the protective value of the formal designations.
And Jake went on to explain to me what is planned for next Saturday morning.
We're meeting at Balcombe Station, which is a station on the London-Brighton line railway, from 9:30 onwards. And between then and 11 o'clock, people will be ferried up to, we've got a car ferry and whatnot to take people up to where the mass trespass will take place. So it's 9:30. Be there or be square. 9:30 to 10:30, Balcombe Station, and we'll take you up to the area we're going to walk in.
So I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the Landscapes for Freedom mass trespass that they're planning for the 24th, the morning of the 24th of September 2022. And I'm sure they'll have an enjoyable day there. Just before we wind up on the discussion we were having with Esther and everyone else earlier on, Enough is Enough is an organisation around the country.
Well, it's been set up by the trade unions, really, with Sympathetic Labour MPs and the people behind it.
Sympathetic, did you say?
Sympathetic, okay. People who are sympathetic to the trade unions.
So there is a public meeting here in Bristol at St George's Hall, that's just up Park Street, on Tuesday the 20th of September. I believe it starts at 7 p.m. or roughly that time, which has been announced as a way for people to get together to organise to fight the attack on our living standards by the energy companies aided and abetted by a certain Liz Truss. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also guest tonight, the Labour Party activist and economist Esther Giles. And from the Bristol Muslim Cultural Society, no, the Bristol's Pakistan Association, Farouk Siddiq. And London-based author for The Battle of the Beanfield, Andy Worthington. Of course, we also had Richie Allen, broadcaster from Manchester too. Thanks also to sound engineer, did very, very well tonight with all these various guests coming in and out, Dave Bazenko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics show page. We'll also find this podcast, full-length interviews, which is of several tonight, and story links, including David Halpin, very fascinating discussion from him, or explanation of the demise, slow demise of the National Health Service from his point of view, and what happened to the Queen, and a comment page, also the email, our email addresses you will find at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, also at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, not necessarily Google, and that's got all the downloads on it too, as well as a little reminder before we start live. Censorship and military disinformation is the norm in the UK today, and the firewall around the Russian news is particularly irksome. Thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and printing presses, and particularly the telecoms networks. They seem to be even more enthusiastic than the government in shutting down any access to what the Russians are saying. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.